we've got WWDC 2020 to talk about this week on Happy Hour. Let's kick it off with just sort of what we thought about the keynote format and how there was no in-person event for this special Apple event, and kind of how they handled that, because it was very, very different from what, you know, previous events have had to be like, right?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, obviously normally for a WWDC event, they'd invite the whole developer crowd. So that's about 5,000 invited developers. Then you have the press as well. And that would normally be done in like a big convention center. Like in recent years, they've done it in McHenry Convention Center. Obviously, that wasn't going to happen this time around because it was all virtual anyway. And so there were lots of questions about how they were going to do it. Was it going to be, you know, just done in people's offices? Was it going to be done in the theater? Was it going to be live streamed? And it was kind of interesting. I don't think anyone was quite expecting how they did it. So obviously, Tim Cook came out at the start, and he was in the Steve Jobs Theater, but obviously the theater was empty, right? And so he was talking to the camera, and they had multiple cameras set up, and so it became very apparent very quickly that it wasn't going to be live streamed at all. This whole video was pre-recorded, right? But it came with production values to match. So like, it was very well produced video where you'd have like Cook come out, he'd do his little intro speech. You know, he addressed obviously the coronavirus situation. He addressed the racism tragedies and equality issues. And then when they got into the operating systems, they were cut back and forth to different people. So you had like Craig and Kevin Lynch, and you had some other faces, many of which we have seen for the first time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the transition's really interesting. So at the very start, they were kind of showing this like globe look down, and it was like little memojis lighting up the earth. Yeah. And they would like zoom all the way into the Apple Park Theater, and it would be like, wow, that was cool. And then, but they also kept doing that when they would switch from place to place. So Craig was like in the atrium bit of the Steve Jobs Theater. So they would have, you know, some sort of drone shot, or maybe it was CGI, it was some combination, fly around the place. And then when they go to the lab, they would fly again. It was really clever, I thought. Like, for given the constraints that they obviously had in the world, they pulled off like quite an impressive package. And it was, what, 1 hour 50, about that?
Yeah, it was like 1:49. I thought that the keynote itself was like probably the most rewatchable keynote in recent years, since like Steve Jobs keynotes that you can just go back and rewatch and just learn things from, about presentation and information. But just in the fact that like the keynote as a 2 hour video to rewatch for disseminating information, it was fast paced. It was dense. There was none of the like crowd shots and handoff time, and like impromptu jokes being made. It was it would be so neat to see kind of the behind the scenes of how the production went. And they even had a thing at the very end of the presentation that was like, it reminded me of like when you see in movie credits, no animals were harmed in the production of this movie. It was like that, but for people because of COVID-19. And it was like, this is how we filmed. Everyone but the presenter wore masks, and
we washed everything down,
right?
Sanitized everything. Yeah, people were separated around. Like,
yeah, exactly.
So they laid it all out.
Yeah. But like just presentation wise, like, you know, I don't know if Apple a decade ago could have pulled it off in quite that way, but they've got so much experience in video production, whether it's from, you know, Apple TV Plus stuff, you know, where they did that keynote, you know, a year and a half ago, where it's about services. Like, that wasn't bought content. It was like where they're like demoing, they're kind of like the master reel of everything. And they've also got all the experience of putting together like the intro videos every year.
And they have a massive like internal marketing department now that they never used to have, right? Like,
sure,
massive,
yeah,
video teams and stuff. Because in the old days, yeah, and when we say old days, you need to go back like 10 years maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was all done with external agencies. You didn't really get the same cleverness of like the videos at the front with the CGI animations, or, you know, the smarts. Like, you'd occasionally get like the Mac versus PC video introduced at WWDC once, or you had like a little Siri skit, but, you know, way smaller scale than what they do in recent years, just because, you know, the company's so big and they also have so many more resources than they ever did before. And I think it really shows at a time like this, right? Like, if you were, you know, like an alien from outer space who wasn't aware of the pandemic situation, and you just watch that video, you probably wouldn't even realize anything was wrong, right?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
It was just so well done and produced that if you didn't know that in a normal year this would have been done in front of a live audience, you'd think this is like how it was done all the time.
Yeah, and I know just from our perspective of covering the keynote by watching the live stream, so covering it for 9to5Mac.com, was that, wow, this feels very dense and fast-paced. And that's because you didn't have so much the downtime of like, here's a game demo, here's a transition.
Or even like pauses for clapping, right? Because they wait for answers. So when they normally, they'd have like a slide where you're just reviewing features, bullet point, bullet point, bullet point, and then they'd wait and you clap. And if we're covering it, that gives us time to type it all down or tweet or do whatever we need. But when it's a fully rehearsed and fully pre-shot video, that, you know, those time instances weren't there. And so from a purely like journalist perspective, it was more annoying, but, you know, that's not who they're aiming for. They're just aiming for, you know, end people watching the video, right?
Yeah. And also kind of behind the scenes for us is that, you know, we've got years and years of experience of planning out how do we cover one of these keynotes ordinarily, which usually relies on like one or two people in attendance, but that's kind of like the least valuable piece of the team because of Wi-Fi issues and networking issues and everything. There's like a little bit of benefit to having someone in the room with like relaying information sooner. This time there was like, you didn't have the effect of on Twitter, there are people in attendance who are like sharing things a few seconds before it's the live stream. But we did the same rhythm of everyone knows what they're covering in advance. So here comes this section, here comes that section. And then in rewatching it, it feels perfectly fine in how it's paced because it's like, you know, here's this thing. And I haven't rewatched the whole thing yet, since the day it was, you know, shown the first time. But, and just starting to do that it definitely feels like a much more digestible pace than you'd have in previous years. So I, for one, am now, you know, concerned about how future years will go in comparison.
I was going to say, do you think they'll do it again? Like, choose to do it?
I don't know. I think they should, but like, because it serves more people better than just who can be in a keynote. But also I think that special events, you know, in a future environment where they can hold them again safely, I think there's also a certain value in that and momentum and enthusiasm and everything.
Yeah, there is like a kind of magic in doing it live, right, in front of real people and doing a demo that, you know, that has a risk of going wrong. Like, that's part of the fun, right? We've seen, you know, Apple screws up on occasion. Like, I think the one that comes to mind most recently was when they did the Face ID demo for the iPhone X, right? And Craig, it was, the phone was like pre-locked or something, so he was like, whoa, and then they had to redo it over and stuff. And like, that shows that the legitimacy of the whole operation. And if it was only pre-recorded videos that are never going to be wrong from here on out, it does kind of lose some of the sparkle, if you know what I mean. Like, and I think in general, I would probably prefer them to go back to standard live keynotes. But for as a developer, the sessions they've been running throughout the week, that format is way better how it is now because they have all the videos already done. They're all perfect and cut down beautifully. There's no random like waiting around for the speaker to move across and change the slide over to get to the laptop to do the demo to walk back. All the videos come out at the same time of the day. Like, I think for WWC next year, they should definitely consider just pre-recording all the session videos, and then that frees up more time for them to do like hands-on labs and stuff if people are getting back in person. So there's still reason to attend, because right now they're having to do the hands-on labs and the interview stuff over, you know, video chat, essentially.
WebEx, right? Yeah.
Yeah, WebEx, yeah. But it's like, having all the videos just drop at the same time every day is so much better because the videos are much higher quality. The keynote itself, Apple is such a like demo-driven and presentation-driven company at its heart. I'd be really surprised if they did like a Nintendo and moved to this kind of style full-time. Maybe they'll do some announcements like that. Like, you could imagine them, like, for what they did with the iPad Pro in March, they could have done like a streamed a video for half an hour where they were talking about all the cool features of the iPad Pro and the Magic Keyboard and stuff. Like, a kind of public announcement, kind of what they do when they do embargoes of press, right? They don't always have to do it behind the scenes. They couldn't make that stuff more public. But for things like WWC or the iPhone keynote, you know, I'd like them to go back to live when it obviously is safe to do so.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely nailed it this time, though. Like,
yeah, as good as it was. As good as it was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's get into what happened in the keynote and kind of just go through in chronological order. So kick us off.
Yeah, so just before we start with iOS 14, let's get a ad out of the way.
Cool, okay.
So Happy Hour this week is brought to you by Clean My Mac X. It's the all-in-one cleaning and optimizing solution for your Mac. It's a single utility that takes care of your Mac's health. It cleans, it's a performance monitor, so much more. You can scan for outdated junk files, easily work out what is using up all your hard drive space, and it can make a virtual visual map of how your storage is distributed across your files and folders. You can declutter cache files, logs, mail attachments that you no longer need, and so much more. It detects it all, and you could potentially save gigabytes of space with a single click. Because unfortunately, when you remove a Mac program, sometimes it leaves little like preference files around or caches that your computer, you know, no longer really uses or it needs. But there isn't a good way to clean that craft out using built-in macOS tools, and that's where Clean My Mac X is to the rescue. And it's designed to be super easy to use. The app will show you step-by-step explanations for every single component, so you can be fully confident in the tweaks that you're making to your system. And the real-time malware monitor scans your Mac for threats and notifies you right in time as soon as it detects something. Clean My Mac makes it easy to optimize your system and run your Mac at peak performance, just like it did when you got it out of the box on day one. Clean My Mac X is available in the Mac App Store and on MacPaw's website. Go to macpaw.com/9to5 to get Clean My Mac X with a 30% discount, valid until July. That's macpaw.com/9to5. Thanks to MacPaw and Clean My Mac X for sponsoring Happy Hour.
Awesome. Yeah, so I took notes like during the keynote until it was time to write my stories on Apple Watch stuff. And that's when I was like, okay, now I'm, you know, not in my notebook anymore. But the first thing I wrote was like Tim Talks, and it was that introduction. It was like, it was such a highly produced way to begin the keynote, and like show the theater and everything, and you know it was so, I think. There was no question of, is this live or not live? Because like what answered that question was the production value was so high.
And the transition. As soon as they started doing some cuts with the camera, and I was like, maybe the Timbit's live, but then it was pretty clear as soon as they started cutting to other people back and forth, it was all pretty done.
Yeah. So I'm going to call this whole thing Tim Talk. So I think it was well done. iOS 14, they cut to Craig. He's in the part of Steve Jobs Theater before you go into the theater room, and then he begins to introduce iOS 14. So let's go down the list of what we have there.
Yeah, so the first thing was what they call the app library, and this is kind of like the app drawer that you get on Android, because it's essentially a way to take app icons out of your home screen, or to just completely hide pages that you no longer like organize or really use, because they kind of admitted that, you know, after like page one, page two, page three, people download so many apps and they don't bother organizing the rest of it. So it just goes on pages and pages endlessly. And so the app library is their kind of attempt to solve that. And what it essentially is like a final page on your home screen that sorts the rest of your apps that aren't visible on those pages that you've manually arranged into like automatic categorization. So you have kind of automatic folders, you have recently added, you have series suggestions, and then like all your Apple Arcade games go in one little folder. And it's quite a clever UI, because you have like three apps in each folder, which are like your recently used ones, and you can just tap them and they instantly launch. And then you've got like a little like more bubble or swirl that you can click on, and then it basically like expands into a full screen folder of everything in that category. And then there's like a search button with like an A to Z list, kind of what we reported earlier in the year, right? And then if you want to, you can manually remove apps from your home screens. You just like go into jiggle mode, say move to app library, and then it will disappear from your home screen. But it's not deleting the app. It's just making it in this separate section only that you can only get to through the app library or just using, you know, Spotlight search. And then they have this kind of really nice shortcut where you can just basically hide an entire page of apps at the same time. So say if you organize page one and page two, but you don't really care about 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you can long press on the little page indicator at the bottom. And then it comes up into this like edit page UI, and you just click like 3, 4, 5, hide. You just uncheck them, and then all the apps from those pages get funneled into the app library instead.
Yeah.
It's an interesting solution to the problem. Obviously, we'll be doing a lot of like iOS 14 impressions as the weeks go on. Initially, I don't know, like it, I kind of feel like you're just trading pages of unorganized apps for a different page of unorganized app. Like, I'm not sure if you're actually gaining much, because I feel like as soon as you're on the app library screen anyway, like, why don't you just search for it by pulling down and just typing the name of the app in? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So my takeaway on this, I mean, so, you know, to talk about both app library and widgets, you sort of need to acknowledge that in the mobile phone space, Android's been doing a version of both of these things for a long time, even if widgets go back to dashboard on the Mac. So the app library, so the alphabetical list thing, it takes, structurally, it's tacked on to the home screen, where mm-hmm. you've got your first page, and they didn't change like page zero. That's still the today view, as they call it. And it shows widgets by default, including the new style and the old style. And only the new style can come to your home screen off of the today view. So you've got page zero, you've got page one through however many, and then the last page is the app library. And I think it's too, even if you only have like one home screen and then app library, it is too many steps to go to the alphabetical list at that point. Like mm-hmm. What I would like to see is you pull down from the home screen, you know, home screen one, and then you go to app library, I think. I would like
yes.
that.
Yes. Yeah. Cause that has a search field in it, right? Cause it's, right now, yeah. when you pull down, you go to the old search experience, which just yeah. has the search field, and then it has the series suggestions.
Yeah. Which can be a widget on page 01, pull down, like it's all over the place now.
And they have series suggestions in the app library itself as one of the folders.
That's
one
right.
of the fake folders is a series suggestion. So
yeah.
That is definitely something that I noticed as well. It's like, so you've got, like you pull down to search, but then you can go all the way to the end of your home screens to mm-hmm. find the app library, and you also search there. So if they unified those together,
yeah.
like it doesn't really seem much reason for them to be split apart.
That would be so cool. It's like you've got your home screen, and there's no like indicator on the bottom. You know, there's like pagination and there's little dots for it. There's not one for app library, and this is all in beta one. Who knows how it'll change? But I think that's one of the pieces of feedback that I hope they hear over the summer, is that like that pull down needs to go to app library where you've got those new collections, and then you tap search, and then you've got the alphabetical list order. Because what I'm finding in the last few days is that, you know, it's cool to have all that automatic assortment, but I'm also finding it more efficient to still type in like two letters of an app name, and then that's how to get to it.
Yeah, you just search on that main screen rather than bothering to go all the way to the end.
Yeah. No, I do love the idea of app library, because what it is, you know, we've had folders on iOS since iOS 4, right? So long ago. And with app library, it's like they've taken folders, and folders never really changed for bigger screen iPhones, like mm-hmm. or iPads. And, you know, it's just like groups of apps.
Because it used to be on like the iPhone 4, it was four across, three down.
Yeah.
Right. And so now they've changed it to 3x3, but you can have unlimited pages.
Yeah, that's the only change to folders. The way that the collections in the app library are, like the way that they look, it feels like if they just were to take away folders or update folders into like folders 2, this is what we'd get. And so I think for most people, this new way of doing things is going to be a leap forward and much better. For me, I've always had page 1 be the apps that I use the most, and then page 2 be just folders, like, you know, 8 folders or so, organized alphabetically and by category. So it was like my own app library. And now I kind of wish that I could name these folders what I want, or the app library collections what I want. Like have the suggested, recently added, arcade, test flight. Those are really, really neat categories to be automatically put together. But like in health and fitness, for example, they've got my dog collar tracker by a company right. called Fi.
Yeah, you can't customize the folders they make yeah. for you. It's just all fixed and automatic. You
yeah.
can't rearrange the order of them. You can't do anything.
And there's like reference and reading gets truncated on an iPhone 11 Pro. And it's like, but visually they're much more functional. They're larger. You know, 3 out of the 4 tiles on the folder preview are tappable apps. I mean, it's like the app there. And then the little like 4x4 grid within the 4x4, that's how you open the folder. And just the animation of opening the folder is way more modern and polished than yeah. you know, the old way. So I hope that they kind of like use this as like, this is the first thing we're going to do, but then you get some more options in terms of like what you can do here, because it's really cool.
Yeah, like even if you could one. Drag, like if mm-hmm. if the app library just stays the drunk drawer page, but you yeah. could like drag out one of those folders and just put them next to your icon, so they'd almost be like a widget, right? So you could just have all the Apple Arcade automatic folder just be a widget that you could just tap in and reveal.
Yeah.
Like, they have a lot of scope to expand there.
Yeah, yeah. So I quite like it. And I think just like big picture, it's that this it's important for Apple not to copy Android features, but to create an environment for switchers where they're comfortable. And if a good idea is a good idea, then to bring it, you know, to take it, not avoid it because it's somewhere else. So I definitely think this is like, you know, this is Apple's take on what's happening on Android phones. And I hope it goes further than what they've got today, because I'm already finding like, oh, I wish it worked a little bit different, you know, than what they've done so far.
Yeah, it's like the classic thing, isn't it, where you wait so long for major updates, and like, this is the biggest update to the home screen since Folders, which is literally a decade ago.
Yeah. When they showed like the history of the home screen, it was like the home screen, the iPhone 1, and they showed like modern iOS, but it was like features that came from ancient iOS, you know? Mm-hmm. And then they like took things like suggestions on the lock screen as like major changes to the home screen. It's like, I guess, but this is really it.
Obviously the thing people are most talking about is the widgets, right?
And when somebody asked me like, what's the biggest change in iOS 14? Like, there's a lot of stuff there, but like, I think visually, like what you see on your home screen is what you're going to interact with the most. And so I say widgets because it's just this is it. This is the update.
It's important to note that by default, the app icon layout does not include any widgets still at all. They're still hidden on that page zero page. For now, maybe they'll change it, but for at least as it is in the current beta, the app icons are laid out on the first page by default, and you have to like proactively drag out a widget to actually, you know, put it there.
Yeah, I think that's the wrong default because it's not as discoverable as if like, whoa, there's now a widget there, and they've got this widget called Smart Stack, and you can also stack any widgets together where they're like swipeable. You can kind of carousel through them. But in marketing images, they show this sort of like, here's a widget, here's four app icons, next row, four icons, here's a widget, and it looks nice. I think something like that might need to become the default, and I wouldn't be surprised if it does, because right now it's like you've got to put it together. Or maybe it's that they don't want to break everyone's home screens, you know, and it would just be on a new install. But you're right. If you do like reset home screen layout, it goes back to, the widgets are over here and the icons are over here, and you've got to merge them together. There is like a default set of widgets though. So like if you ever were to reset your home screen, it puts your home screen page one on like Apple's order of their apps, and then everything else goes alphabetical. They've never touched what happens to the widgets there. And now the widgets get reset to like what they want to show you too.
And I think like the weather is like a perfect example, right? Because the smallest widget is basically just like a 2x2 app icon. It's just an app icon that's slightly bigger.
It's the size of four app icons, right?
Size of four app icons. Yeah. So in a future like default home screen arrangement, why have, you know, the static weather icon there when you can have the widget instead, right?
Right. Yep.
And I feel like the weather is one of the leading reasons why people want widgets. It's why I've wanted widgets for ages. I just want to see the weather on my home screen. Like half the widgets in the widget library, I'm never going to use because they're just unnecessary, right? Like I don't care about seeing music albums on my home screen, but you know, calendar maybe, weather for sure. They're like each person's going to have their one or two widgets that they really, really want to have, and they're so important to them, right? And so they can lay them out, and I feel like weather is a good enough default that could actually make the default set at some point.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Because that's what I want. As soon as I upgraded to iOS 14, I was like, well, I don't want this stupid weather icon anymore. I want the widget. And so what I did is I long pressed on the icon, and I was looking, because you know, in the old version, they put like the widget above when you run on the little like force press menu, the long press menu. It would show you a widget above. Well, that's gone now. It only shows you the menu. Mm-hmm. And because what I was thinking in my head was, I'll just long press on the icon, and then surely there's just going to be like replace widget button. So it would just swap the icon out for the widget. But that flow doesn't really exist. So it's kind of awkward now because you have to like hold on the icon, then you have to delete the app, but not actually delete the app, send it to the app library. Then you can swipe to the home screen page. Then you can find the weather app. Then you can pick the 2x2 one, and then you can drag it out. So there are some like onboarding steps they can probably improve there.
Sure.
Because also once you put a widget on your home screen, you can't change the size of it. You just have to delete the widget and go and get it again from scratch.
Right? Yeah, so yeah. And they didn't have like a way to change widgets. So it's a couple of things. I'm doing like three widgets on the home screen. And so it's like what you'll see in Apple's defaults, where it's like a widget, four icons, a widget, four icons. And that's the whole home screen. They've got this concept of like stacking widgets. So they have one that's called Smart Stack. And that's just like every widget that Apple makes in one, you know, it isn't really intelligent. It's just like, this is all that we make, and, you know, have at it.
It's supposed to change which ones are visible to you depending on your needs, but we'll see.
Yeah, there's a very small number of widgets that are in that category. So like when do you, you know, when do exactly, yeah. But so what I like is the small widget size where it's 4x4, and then to stack those, where I've got a slot that I do for a widget. And so, in like the top left corner, I'm doing, calendar, and then I'm looking at, I don't invest in stocks, but I'm using the stocks widget because I'm looking at like what is happening with Virgin Galactic or Peloton or Apple. So as company, and then, you know, launch that, go to Apple News from there. So I've got that there. The next one I've got, I'm kind of doing these as like related to each other. Weather, like you mentioned, the activity rings. And that's another thing where like, if they did like live app icons, activity rings is something people ask about. It's like, why can't that be a live version of your rings? Well, now it can be. It just happens to take up four icons. but for that reason, it's like, okay, I can swipe through these, and it's not just like one widget for the sake of four in the place of four icons. It's like I can do multiple in this place. And I'm doing maps there as well as like my maps app launcher. And it's just kind of neat to see that the icon for it is where you are. And then I am doing some media ones as my third widget on my last row, which is podcast stuff. So it's like you're currently playing podcasts if you're doing that, or recently played. The last thing with music, and then photos where it recommends memories. So it's like those are like my media widgets. So
yeah, the photos one's nice.
Yeah. And then on I've got a second page where I've got like battery and then a topic in news and then a few more app icons there, and then that's it. But I'm happy with the amount of kind of what you can do so far. Like you mentioned, you can't resize them from the widget. You've got to like go into the add page and add a new one of that size. With the stacked widgets though, you can edit, you long press one and you get like the little pop out menu, and you can edit the stack where you rearrange the order of those widgets. You can turn off smart rotate where it tries to be intelligent about what to show you. And if it's a news widget, you can select the topic there. So by default, I think it picks a topic for you, and then you can go and change that or remove that part of the stack. So they do have like the infrastructure for where would you change the size of a widget. It would be in that menu, I think.
Yeah, like when you like edit a widget, it kind of flips around and shows you the back, and they have like the options for customizing the data, but also there it would probably make sense to just a quicker way to change, you know, small, medium, large.
Yeah.
To start over from scratch.
And all of this in beta one in the beta season is that it's all the first party widgets, and Apple's not made like a widget for every app in every context. And we don't have any third party widgets yet, but I think
some widgets are still to come in later seeds. Like they show on the marketing website, a clock widget where you just get the clock, but bigger.
Yeah.
And that's not in the current beta. So
there's a lot of stuff. We'll see more.
I will say though, I'm really happy with like how the whole thing looks. The animations are really cool. When you drop a widget down, they will kind of like ripple around it. It's very reminiscent of like the dashboard animation.
Yeah, the map. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that went away.
sadly it did go away, but they kind of brought it back and it's really, really nice. Yeah. What do you think about the fact that like the widgets can't have interactivity? They can only launch the app. So they're kind of basically like complications, right?
Yeah.
They're like watch complications brought to the home screen.
They use that framing too when they introduced widgets. It was like, we've learned from the Apple Watch kind of thing, which I thought was initially like their way of saying, we're not copying Android, or the Mac. But I mean, they killed widgets on the Mac. I mean, you've got widgets in the Today view, and now there's Control Center, but, or that notification center over there. But I think it's okay. I think as long as they update reliably, we're in the beta season right now. So for example, the activity widget is often incorrect, and the current weather location keeps defaulting to Cupertino, even though, you know, I've given permission to use my location. But that's just beta stuff, you know. As long as they do update reliably and in time, and like I look at my watch and it's the same as what shows, you know, for activity rings as the widget, and it gets the opportunity to refresh, I think I'm okay with that.
Watch complications are never out of date. Like, you never look at your activity rings and they're wrong, right?
Right.
At the moment, when you look on the iPhone, the activity rings can be a bit delayed, and they obviously have like performance policies and stuff to stop a widget from updating too frequently. But clearly, for stuff like the activity rings, the API is designed so that, oh, at the start of the next day, they can be told to refresh and, you know, go back to zero. Or if you've had it plugged in, they should be able to refresh more frequently. And some of that stuff is clearly just a bit buggy at the moment. But they'll get there. That's fine.
Yeah.
I think for year one, not having any interactivity at all is fine. It does preclude some kind of like a better popular widget on Android is like a now playing widget, which just shows you you're currently playing music and you a play pause or a next track button. Kind of basically what you get in Control Center.
I mean, Apple could do that and just not allow other apps to do it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe they do that, but stuff of that domain, right? Like, I don't think you want super complicated widgets, but maybe some stuff could benefit from like a button or two. But again, for a year one, 1.0 situation, I think it's fine. And, you know, and currently the old style widgets are still available.
Mm-hmm.
On that page zero, they're stuck at the bottom. You can't drag them out between your app icons like anything.
So I'm only using that page for the old widgets, ones that I actually use. So like I've got Natapmo for the weather station there, and then deliveries, and that's like the, and now that you can take icons from your home screen and then put them in the app library only, then widgets can replace icons as launchers, and so it all kind of fits this model of like what you see on the home screen. It may or may not have information, but it's how you launch the app. And so that's what I'm doing with the old school widgets too, is I don't have the icon for those apps on the home screen anywhere. That's how I launch the app. But usually I can see what I want to see without having to launch the app. And that's the widget. So.
Yeah, indeed. Another thing I'm really happy they brought to the iPhone this year is a picture in picture.
Yeah, they called this... that part of the home screen redesign.
So they did this first on the iPad in 2015, right? With iOS 9. Because that's when they started doing like multitasking specific changes for iPad. But for whatever reason, it took them 5 years to bring it to the phones. And, you know, it's been a request from me and you for a while, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and, you know, loads of Android phones do it already. And it's just a nice feature that lets you easily multitask between watching a video and doing something else. Like, I can watch a video. If you message me, I can just switch the messages and type back, and the video doesn't get paused. It just carries on playing in a little box, and you can just flick the box around to different corners and just carry on. It also works for like FaceTime calls.
That's where it matters for me the most.
Yeah.
Because I'm always seeing, not just me, but like as the person on the other end of the call, that someone that I called to FaceTime with will then browse on their phone, and I'm looking at paused, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that's not the case. If they have 14, then they pip. And then they continue offering their video to you without that paused interaction.
Yeah, and especially when you've got bigger phones like the 6.1-inch phone, the iPhone 11 Max, which is 6.5, and then later this year they're going to do 6.7. Only having one app on the screen at a time does start to feel limiting. And so stuff like picture-in-picture offers a really nice way of just adding basic multitasking features that people use every single day. Like, loads of people are watching videos on their phone and they just want to do something else really quick. And so it's a really nice way of like adding multitasking to the iPhone without making it super complicated. So I'm really happy that that's finally arrived on the phone.
Yeah, it was funny when they showed it, like the picture in picture, the pip pushed off screen, and they're like, it even keeps playing sound. It's like, this is how it works. We know.
Yeah, we've done this before. We've been this isn't a new rodeo.
Yeah. Next up, I suppose, would be Siri, and it's pretty good year for Siri. I mean, it isn't in like what Siri can do, but it's in how Siri's presented, I think, is the way I look at it.
Yeah, so they had that line where it's like, Siri's learned 20 times more facts than 3 years ago, which means they're incorporating changes that we've already seen, right?
So yes, not right. Yeah.
To this year. Mm-hmm. But it was funny. They showed some like sample questions like, how do hybrid cars work, for instance? And so I just asked my Siri the exact same question, and it didn't know. So some of it's still, you know, rolling out and stuff, but they are at least addressing, like, this is the first time in a while where they've had an Apple representative come on the stage and say, look, we are making Siri better in this way, and this is what's happening. Yeah. It's not a giant leap. It's not some, like, quantum jump. But, you know, paying attention to it is very nice, because previously, whenever we've had, like, a Siri segment, it's just been about how well their new voice can synthesize and make it sound like a human, right? Which is what nobody really cares about. They want to hear, like, the intelligence of Siri. And so they did address that. They also allow that you take audio messages over Siri. So rather than just transcribing to text, you can do just a voice message, which is nice on occasion.
I haven't tried this with CarPlay, but CarPlay had an update in iOS 13 where for the first time you could play an audio message, which to me, like, the context is you're driving. You don't want to be fooling around with dictation that can be unreliable, or like having to correct it 5 times before it gets it right. So in my 2014 review of CarPlay on iOS 8.1, I wrote, this needs to be able to send audio messages and play them back. And some update to 13 added playback, but you still couldn't send. And so for me, like, this addition to Siri is really like solving that problem for CarPlay that I had in 2014 of I'm driving, dictation is failing every time for whatever reason, you know, complexity. Let me just record my voice and send it over as a message so that person can play it back. And now you can.
Yeah. And then, like, the biggest change for Siri this year, it seems, is they've done, like, a UI refresh. So previously, Siri was, like, this full-screen experience, and it would blow the background, and, you know, your conversation would appear above. And what they've done now, essentially, is that you get it slightly dims the background, but mostly it just adds, like, this circle, which is the Siri, like, globe to the bottom of the screen.
Yeah.
And then you ask a question, and then the answer just, like, comes in from the top, kind of like a banner notification. That's not actually a notification. So you kind of be able to, like, retain the context of what you're doing while you're asking Siri a question, which is something I've actually asked for in a previous episode of this show. Although it is a bit odd in beta one, like, you can't actually carry on using your app while you ask Siri a question, either on the phone or the iPad. And, like, on the iPad, Siri's just this tiny little globe in the bottom right-hand corner. But if you ask it a question and you, like, oh, so let me say, let me look up this calculation while I'm also still scrolling Twitter, as soon as you put your screen on the screen to scroll the Twitter app, it cancels and dismisses Siri completely. So it kind of defeats the point. Like, you can refer to what's on the screen, but you can't actually interact with the app while you're actually asking Siri a question. Yeah. Which is exactly what you can do on the Mac, at least you can in Catalina.
Yeah, it's like touch without multi-touch. Multi is very important there.
And again, it is beta one, so that's the kind of stuff they can change. Because the way I was imagining it was working, it was like, it would come up on the screen, and then it wouldn't dismiss till you, like, did the home button gesture to swipe it off, if you see what I mean. But the fact that you just literally, like, touch the app underneath and it goes away just seems a bit silly to me.
Yeah.
So. But the UI is quite nice, and it's interesting that by default now, they hide the transcription, so you can't even see what you're saying and what it thinks you're saying. There's an option and a setting to turn it back on again, but it was kind of disorientating the first time I did it. I was like, okay, it's heard me, I guess. Oh, there's the answer. Okay, it was right. But it was kind of funny that now they feel so confident in being able to transcribe correctly, they don't even show you
what
you said.
And there's no more opportunity for screenshotting, you know, bad transcriptions and answers.
Yeah.
Because you can't screenshot an audio interaction unless you turn it back on.
That's a fair point. Yeah, and you can turn it on if you're really, like, sensitive to that stuff and you want it.
That's right. But at that point, you'll have to re-ask your question if you want to screenshot it and make a meme. It goes viral.
And as rumored, they did introduce a translate app.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. It does offer offline translation. It's very similar to, like, the Google Translate app that you can get in the App Store today, but obviously it's, you know, Apple solution, you can do it offline. I think it has fewer languages than the Google version, because I think they said
11?
English, Mandarin, French, German, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Korean, Arabic and Portuguese and Russian. So a pretty decent set of languages. But not like, I'm pretty sure Google Translate does like 50 languages or something insane. But for, you know, for a step one, it's pretty good. And they have, like, the conversation mode where you can turn it sideways and then I can talk in English and it will translate into what the other person's talking. They can talk back in their foreign language and it will do it automatically. So it seemed pretty neat.
Yes.
Again, we'll have to wait for, like, real world evaluations of how good is the, you know, how good is the quality of the translations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And before you could ask Siri, like, as an inquiry, how do you say something in Spanish and it would, like, play it back for you? But it wasn't a translate interaction app like it is, like a Translate is. And I was at Disney World, like, over a year ago, I saw a staff member interacting with a customer in a different language, and that's how they were using Google Translate to, like, go back and forth. And so now it's built into the phone. You know, they go and add it to it. So that's neat.
Yeah, and it does use the network if the internet's available, and if the network's not available, then it does the offline only version.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, like, super sensitive about privacy, if you go into settings, translate, there is an option which says basically always use the offline only translation, but the quality of the translations will not be as good because the server ones are better.
The icon is not great.
The icon is pretty bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
At least it's not a white background, but it's not, you know, it's only a slight tier above that on the quality list.
Black background. So. What's next? Messages, right?
Messages.
Yeah. Messages. It's okay. Widgets and messages. This is, like, the two things that people can interact with the most, I think, and really get out of iOS 14. I can just say from using it, the features that I've already started to use that were presented in the keynote is pinning conversations to the top of the screen so that they're always above the other ones. I'm really enjoying that. One way I'm using that is that if it's someone who I don't talk to often, but it's important that I talk to them, then pinning them is a good way to have them up there, because otherwise they'd be at the top of the list anyway if it was, like, frequent conversations. I don't message my mom all the time, but, like, it's an easier way to put her up there now. And then
it's almost like VIPs, right?
Yeah. So that's neat. And then with the group chats, being able to, it's so minor, but being able to add in that, like, your own picture to the group chat and, like, name it like that is, it's cool. And, but they've done a good job with the UI of it. Like, if someone responds in a group chat, then their avatar will be like around the picture of the group chat, you know, and they show when there's typing in one of the pinned messages and, you know, what they've said, if they've sent the message. So there is some cool stuff there. Someone in the chat.
The pinning UI kind of reminds you of like Instagram stories or like Snapchat stories because it's just little circles with the profile pictures.
Yeah. Someone in the chat mentioned that they wish that you could pin the conversation to the bottom. And I think that must be because, you know, phones are, you know, in part the phones are big, you know. And so one thing I picked up on this is that with widgets, like your icons are still on the top of the home screen by default. Like you can't just put them anywhere on your home screen. But you can bring down important ones by putting like a big widget up top, you know, and it's kind of that way with pinned messages too, where if like there's someone that you don't chat with frequently, but you want to pin them, it can put the ones that you use the most in better reach. So
yeah, you want like a static toolbar that can just hold the icons rather than be all the way at the top of the screen. Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And they have inline replies now, so you don't have to like always respond to the message at the bottom. You can go up a few and it kind of links them together. Kind of like, you know, impromptu threading type of situation.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have mentions, obviously. So if you've got like a busy group chat, you can turn off notifications in general. But if you get mentioned with your name, then it will send you a notification. So they are bringing, you know, a bit more sophistication to the group chat, like service of iMessage.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll get to the Mac, you know, version of messages. It's this. But you can kind of look at that and say, like, they've had some features on the Mac messages that they got replaced. And I think being alerted when you're mentioned is one of those things. And so that could be an influence on, like, why do this now? That was one of the things they wanted to have on the Mac, you know, to get in there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the reply UI is interesting. It's kind of clever, but it's also, I don't know, I have to spend more time with it to really know what I think about, like, the UI work on it. But the idea is fine.
The mentioning interface is different in the keynote than what you've got on the device too, because you've got to like at and put their name on beta one. You can type their name and it'll like show a different color, but in the keynote it pops up with their picture or something like that.
Yeah, it does like autocomplete. Yeah.
And it isn't there on the beta one yet, so I imagine this gets more polished over time. But you know, I think we've seen like with Slack, you can do threads very badly, and people will not like it or use it. Where they've got these replies in line, it's once you figure out like where the lines are going and how it's supposed to work, it can be useful, especially in a group chat, or if like, you know, you're in the UK and so you're it's every night and I'm messaging you and you wake up to like five things from me in the morning, you can reply to the specific things and context, you know, without
because normally like if I go to sleep, you'll send me like a tweet, then you'll say some random comment, and then 4 hours later you'll say something else. And
to be able
to reply to both those independently is actually quite nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So messages. Good update there.
Yeah. And then we had the maps update, which is obviously quite ironic because at the moment nobody's going anywhere. But
which they addressed in a good way in the keynote. It was like, we know that the world's different now, but it won't always be this way. And when it gets back to normal, here's maps, CarPlay, and something else, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they did address it in quite a clever way. Mm-hmm. And so they first said that obviously the like Apple Maps 2 rollout finished in the US last year, and they promised it was coming to more countries this year. They honed in a bit and said that would be the UK, Ireland, and Canada sometime later this year. Mm-hmm. And then they got Meg Frost up, who talked about the like new UI features of the app, and they're doing like travel guide kind of stuff, which is like editorial recommendations of places in certain cities. They're doing collaborations with, you know, local city planner stuff, so that's kind of interesting if you're just like going to somewhere new and looking for stuff to do and you're looking for inspiration. I tried to find one of these guides, but I think they're only in like the US at the moment, so it's quite limited. But you know, baby steps, they'll roll over time. And as an individual, you can even make your own guides. Mm. Like, I can make a guide for you if you were coming to the UK.
Yeah.
And because you can, like, share them around. You can't make them, like, public, but you can share them, you know, with, like, friends and family.
That's cool. And that part kind of builds off of the collections feature from last year. And so I've been using that every time, when you could travel and safely, I would make a trip. And, like, every place we tried and we liked, I added to the collection so we could go back there. And so now you can kind of be, like, the curator of a guided, you know, a visit. So I like that a lot.
Yeah, they're doing cycling directions now.
Yeah, it's... I think it's well done. They called it like the top requested feature. It's just limited to a select number of cities. So, you know, as it goes for maps, you know, it's typical. But it seems to be well done. So they said New York. I mean, this covers a lot of area, New York, LA, San Francisco, and then, China, including Shanghai and Beijing. Mm-hmm. So it isn't like you can just like take maps and then get biking directions anywhere. You've got to be in a select location, but the way they showed it, you know, where you get this way, if you don't mind taking your bike up some stairs, you can save time, or you can look to avoid stairs altogether, sort of like you can avoid tolls on a highway for directions. It looked neat,
and they show like a little graph of the elevation and stuff.
Which is an important piece of, you know, what to expect on a route when you're cycling. So it does look nice. It's going to be a slow rollout, it seems, though.
Yeah, and they're doing like electric vehicle routing now, so you can sync up with your car and you can tell it like what type of charger your car has. Compatible models. I think they said BMW and Ford.
Right. Yeah. So notably in this and the CarPlay section, you've got to leave out Tesla because there's not a partnership there, but it's useful. And Tesla has its own solutions for these things anyway.
Yeah, obviously, if you have a Tesla, you can just use their mapping, and it will tell you where to go to their charge and stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In more general, it makes sense to put it into like the Maps app too.
Yeah, for all the other companies that aren't Tesla, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they're like marking congestion zones in big cities. So like in London, obviously, we have the congestion area, and so they're going to like shade that on the map, and you can. You know if you're like allowed in there and stuff. And there are cities in like China, I think Beijing, where you're only allowed in the city center on certain days. So to stop popular overpopulation, overcrowding, they only let like people's surnames that begin with A, B, and C on this day, you know, like and rotate it around like that. And they're even integrating that in. So you can type in your like profile ID and it'll tell you, okay, on these days you can actually go here, right? So it's, you know, doing more localization, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, that's a foreign concept to me, but it is a cool feature of maps for a big user base.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, and then CarPlay, something that's, I've been using CarPlay since 2014, like in October, when it first came to an aftermarket display, before it even came to like a new car you could buy. So I've kind of been obsessed with like tracking its progress over the years. And in 5.5 years' time, we've now added wallpapers. You know, there's one thing that we reported that hasn't come out yet, which is you know, this new feature of interacting with wallpapers on iOS and having third party wallpapers integrated with settings. Not here yet. You know, it's one of those things where features get turned on and off as they're completed. And maybe this was tied to that, but I also think that last year when they introduced light mode for CarPlay, that you took the background from being just black, like the first iPhone, to being white. And a lot of the icons looked really bad in that way. And so did the dashboard view of like, you know, the car kind of CarPlay version of like widgets that are fixed in place. And so by doing this, all of a sudden you can use light mode and not have a harsh home screen. If you also get the benefit of like, if you have dark mode, you can have a dark mode wallpaper, and you can't do things like have your custom wallpaper on CarPlay. So you can't just have like a picture of something that you like. It's independent from your phone. So at first I thought it was like connected because it was the same default as what that was on the phone. And then I realized that you got to go into settings and change it. I think it's like 5 or 6 options there. And it's just like the default, you know, iOS 14 wallpapers, basically. They react to light mode and dark mode, but it's a small thing, but like it makes a big difference in terms of like how it feels and fresh and everything. And also stock infotainment systems typically have wallpapers too that are pretty bad, but at least there's something there. And now CarPlay does too. And I could see in the future them opening it up to be like other wallpapers and, you know, that kind of thing. But
yeah, and they're expanding like what CarPlay apps can be. They're doing apps for like parking and electric vehicle charging and ordering food, so you can like, I don't know, have like a McDonald's app on your dashboard while you're like, you can like order your meal as you go into the parking lot or something, I guess.
Yeah, so it's kind of nebulous as to like what those things mean. We'll see.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have a good idea of that yet.
And then their big feature for this kind of like CarPlay section was Car Key.
Which is like
talking about for a while.
Yeah, which is kind of separate from the CarPlay experience, really.
Yeah,
it's that they've got this whole system for virtual car keys, where they can be distributed over iMessage, or, you know, you can control permissions with what the car, virtual car key can do, but it's meant to use your iPhone, as your car key to unlock the car, lock the car back, and then to start it. And I guess there's kind of like two pieces to this. So in our reporting of it and our research on the topic, we learned this was in development, and we got much of the user interface before it was announced. But also we realized that there's this consortium of manufacturers that are working on the standard. And so it kind of sounds like Apple, what they announced is that they're doing their version of it with BMW and a 2021 BMW, I think a 5 series. And that'll be available as an update in iOS 13, but they're also taking what they made and contributing it to the standard. And then there'll be wider adoption through that, and that will be more available later.
Yeah, and it sounds like up front they're going to do cars just through NFC, but longer term they want to take advantage of like the U1 chip and ultra wideband and do it that way.
Instead. Yeah,
so you wouldn't even have to take the phone out of your pocket to unlock the car.
And if you look at that, the consortium that's been working on this, there's three phases so far that they published, and I think the first phase is like NFC only, and then it becomes ultra wideband chips. You know, which was published like. I think in December. So U1 was there already. But so they're not using that version. And I think it's just that it's the standard isn't there yet for the cars to adopt. So
yeah, Apple said you can expect to start seeing like UWB compatible car key stuff next year. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit, you know, of a wide time frame, especially given that the U1 chip came out last year now, and we're still kind of waiting for a good use of it.
But. Yeah, we saw something interesting, and we'll get to a lot more like tidbits and stuff next week as we kind of unpack this throughout the summer. But one thing we saw so far is that it seems to be for the Apple Watch, I think this is for car key, right? That it's Series 5 only or later?
Yes.
And not Series 4, which has the same chip essentially, and Series 3, which runs the software update.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why that is.
Yeah, that's one of those weird things.
I think it was cool, though, when you make the car key, you can like share it to a friend and give them like limited access. So yeah. I guess you can say, oh, you can only have it for half an hour, you can only go in this distance or something.
Yeah, this will be really cool in 10 years or so. Like,
I mean, you can add it to the list of like gym kit stuff.
Yeah, but with CarPlay, like it was, they showed iOS in the car, and then like a year and a half later or whatever, they showed CarPlay and like released it, and it took forever. But at this keynote, they could say that 97% of cars today in the US have CarPlay, and they just have to exclude Tesla, basically. And then, you know, a few other brands, I guess. But, you know, that's 2014 to now, 2020. So in less than 10 years, it's now kind of it's in ads and it's everywhere. Maybe car key will be there, but that could also be one of those like high end things that doesn't. CarPlay is not a high end thing. It's usually in the standard trim or like one level up.
So. Yeah, I'm sure wireless phone based car key activation will trickle down the lineup eventually. It'll just take years to actually get there. So yeah. It's, you know, widely available.
So we'll see in 2026 what we're talking about with car key. And
yeah, when Apple has its own car out, so it doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
And then finally, in like iOS, they were talking about app clips, which are essentially you can use a link or you can use a QR code, or they even have their own like custom design QR code stuff, which has a NFC tag built into it. Mm-hmm. And it basically launches a mini app experience. So rather than having to download a full app to do something quickly, you can download an app clip, which only has like, you know, it's small in file size, and so it downloads really quickly, and then you can do one or two actions that you need to and carry on with your day. So if you go to like a parking terminal and you need to pay for the ticket, you can just like tap your phone on the NFC reader, it downloads the app clip like immediately, and you can, you know, Apple Pay and leave, rather than having to, you know, have the app fully installed, go and get it to the app store, you know, mess around with it. And the app clips like automatically delete themselves after a month, and they never go to the home screen, they only sit in the app libraries kind of situation. So basically they're giving you a way to have like transient mini apps to use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is, if you spend time in big cities, you see, it's, you know, just as like a, if you live in a big city, then you kind of have your apps that are in your rotation. But if you just go and visit for something, then you've kind of got to like assemble your visiting apps, and you only need them when you're in town. And oftentimes it's like, you know, you've got really bad network connection then because towers are slammed and it's hard to get the whole app to download. So this is a great save, for this. This is one of those things that we reported on, before. I think it kind of went under the radar though, because I was talking about it last week on some different podcast appearances where it's like, what do we expect to see? And for a lot of people, it was news, but I think this was from like March or so. It was, it was, you know, out there. But it's just as we expect.
And obviously we have to kind of like just see how people adopt it or whether it gets uptake or not. Like, because do you remember last year? It was literally like a year ago this time where Apple announced new initiatives for Apple Pay, where you'd be able to like pay for a bike or an EV bike or whatever, or a scooter just by tapping the phone and then walking off. And that never actually happened. So I think they've kind of funneled that idea into this App Clips stuff.
Yeah, because App Clips benefits from signing with Apple and Apple Pay to skip account creation and credit card input.
And you can have like UI and do stuff, whereas the original pitch last year was just literally just scan it and then that would be it. But that's kind of limiting for, you know, account management and stuff.
Yeah, like that. And that announcement wasn't like an Apple event. It was Jennifer Bailey, the head of Apple Pay, at like an e-wallet, gathering of some sort. So that was kind of an odd one.
You can imagine theoretically that like a restaurant could have an App Clip for just like their menu, and you could, you know, because some like fancy restaurants now you order on the app and you don't have to like, you know, go and find a waiter or whatever. And so you could imagine if they put like a little App Clip code on the menu that's on your table, you could just scan that and order without you having to like mess around, go to the app store and download the application. Yeah. So there are uses for it, and I'm sure like this will probably link into AR stuff down the road, where you can like scan the AR QR code and it, you know, launches augmented reality experiences as well. But we'll have to see if it actually gets play or not.
Because I think it will. I think that the Android version, which is called Slices, which is like Apple Slices, is way funny in my head. I think that App Clips will be widely adopted, and you don't need 500 App Clips. You just need like 12 really popular ones to be useful.
I'm sure Starbucks is probably doing App Clip for their app instead of everyone having to download it all the time. Because it's also just promotion, right? It's like the first time you do it, you scan it, you do a clip, and then you're like, oh, I want that for the next time I go. So then you can like download the
flow. And the Apple Store experience where you can check out with the app, you know, I talked about in the show before, like it used to be a whole process of enter your credit card and, you know, no one wanted to do that. And now if it could be an App Clip and an Apple Pay, then it's really seamless, because you can't like take your iPhone without the Apple Store app and check out. You need the Apple Store app. The Clip could do that. I also love the idea of scooters. So I've done a lot of like when you go to a big city and they've got the electric scooters out that you can rent, you'll see like three different companies with those. And so you'll need all three apps based on like what is available. And this will solve that problem too. And then competitively, like, you know, if you have to have a full app or it works with an App Clip, then you're more likely to like pick up the one with an App Clip if they're like all side by side. So, you know, it's definite reasons to adopt this. I think it'll be popular. All right. Do you want to take an ad break there?
Yeah. Okay. So cool. Just before we get into iPadOS, let's take a break and talk about Mac Stadium. They're the provider of cloud solutions that are built on Apple Mac hardware. And as more teams are working from home, having your Mac build infrastructure hosted in the cloud makes it easy to continue with app development, and no need to have someone in the office doing the admin and the maintenance. It's WWDC week. It's for developers. You can just let Mac Stadium do it for you. Whether you need a single Mac Mini or a fully scalable private cloud of Macs, Mac Stadium can help you move your iOS and your Mac app development workflows into the cloud. Do you need a fast, scalable, modern way to run Mac virtual machines? Orca is Mac Stadium's virtualization platform that is purpose-built for exactly this, running iOS, macOS continuous integration. It's built on Kubernetes, and it has plugins for all the popular CI tools. So if you're building apps for the Apple ecosystem, learn more about Mac Stadium at macstadium.com/95Mac. And as a special offer for 95Mac and Happy Hour listeners, during WWDC week, Mac Stadium is offering half off your first 6 months to a Mac Mini subscription. Just use promo code WWDC2020. Visit macstadium.com/95Mac for details. Thanks to Mac Stadium for sponsoring the show.
All right, cool. So iPadOS. This was presented largely by, I think, Josh Schaefer is his name. And he's the head of...
Craig, like, introed it. And then for the app update stuff, they went over to Josh Schaefer.
Yeah, and he leads Swift UI. Is that right?
Yeah, that was interesting. They showed
on... Wasn't really a connection there.
Yeah, they said like director of Swift Framework, so he's like the Swift UI guy. So I'm not quite sure why he was running the iPad section, but I know he used to work on the UIKit team, so it's kind of related. But you'd think they would have like a head of iPad now that they have an OS that's literally named iPad OS. But so yeah, I noticed that too. It was a bit strange.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. iPad OS. So last year, you know, got the name changed from iOS to iPad OS because it's this dedicated version that's got features that are unique to the iPad that will never be on the iPhone. And part of that push was to say there will no longer be kind of this TikTok year of iOS gets updated for the phone, and then every other year or every 3 years, there's a major iPad update to iOS.
I mean, Apple never said that.
No, but it was implied, and especially in, like, I think even in, like, the Credit Federighi, like, podcast interviews that came after that, it was really pushed. Do you think this year hits the mark of iPadOS having its own name, even though we noticed the same, like, code base is, you know, the same? And
probably not.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty small-scale year update for the iPad. And half the features that we just talked about in iOS 14, they don't even work the same, right? So the app library doesn't exist on the iPad. So you can't put an app in a library on the iPad.
The new widgets are there, but they can't go on your home screen. They're only on the little sidebar from last year.
Yeah, so the stupid little sidebar that introduced last year, now it can have the new widgets in there, but you can't put widgets among your icons, which is a silly restriction.
And like, it's beta 1, but they didn't show it either.
Yeah, and if you actually look at the UI of, like, you drag the widget out of the little sidebar and it kind of, like, lights up, it's pretty clear they've done it on purpose. Like, the behavior is not, like, accidental. It's like, there are technical reasons why it's slightly harder on the iPad than the phone. For a start, obviously, like, the app icons can be different sizes, like, you have the two layout modes, but that could probably be pretty easy fixed just by having, like, dynamic metrics for the widgets. The bigger problem is, like, rotation. So on the iPhone, the grid's fixed, right, and it doesn't go anywhere. Whereas on the iPad, you know, where the widget would be would have to move around when you went to landscape, and they'd have to preserve the layout of the icons when you went back and forth, right?
Yeah.
So that is a stumbling block. I'm sure it's able to be overcome, but I can imagine them being like, this is too hard, we'll defer it for later. And that's why it's not there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The biggest feature, just looking at my notes, that stands out, well, there's a few things, but one of the things that is one of the keys is the sidebar on apps like Photos. It becomes more like what you see on a Mac, and you see a lot less of a tab bar. And that seems like just whatever you want to call that approach to making the tablet apps more like desktop apps than like phone apps is kind of the theme of this release. So, I mean, that does fit under the iPad OS framing. You know, music gets a big update in that regard, in some ways better than the Mac version now. But
they revamped like the Files app with this new kind of sidebar approach, and you can collapse everything, and they've improved the navigation. They've kind of bring in like drop down menus to the iPad, so you can just like long and press and just scroll and let go and do a quick action. So there is, you know, iPad specific stuff, but nothing like fundamentally different, right? Like multitasking hasn't been addressed, for instance.
Yeah.
And the music update is really nice because the music app got absolutely like destroyed in the iOS 7 transition. Like, they used to have this really nice experience that would take full advantage of the iPad canvas. Then iOS 7 came along and the music app got stripped down to bare pieces on the iPad. So it's literally just like the phone app scaled up. And they've like done slight adjustments to it in the interim years. But now they actually have like a version of music for iPad that does actually take advantage of the screen. And so you have like the nice sidebar on the left, and you can quickly switch between your library or the different categories or the playlists. And then they have like a full screen now playing experience where you can have the, you know, the real time lyrics next to the stuff that's playing. So the music app update is really nice and really welcome, for sure. But it does kind of like the overall theme was like, oh, okay, iPad OS is a quiet year this year.
Yeah. We thought that iPad OS 13 was a big year for the iPad. So it was like one of those big tick years. And then in previous years, we'd expect this to be kind of a talk year where it's like just refinements and not major changes. But imagine if cursor support didn't come until 14 and the smart keyboard, keyboard didn't come until 14 was available. Then we'd think of iPad OS 14 as like a bigger deal. Mm-hmm. And there were signs that the cursor support stuff was in the works for 14. And then it seems to be that it was readied earlier and then it became part of 13.
Because they got it out with the 2020 iPad Pro release.
That's right. Yeah. And so I think if you put those together, then it's more like, you know, just the last 2 years have been pretty good for the iPad.
Yeah, and they definitely tried to trade on that, right? Because in the iPad section, they did a recap of the iPad OS 13.3 features. And they're like, remember the trackpad stuff? That was really cool, wasn't
and that,
it?
And like, that was never shown at WWDC last year as part of 13. It wasn't like we're planning on doing this next spring. It was just, yeah, exactly. Here it is now. Yeah, so.
But I think everyone kind of knew. As soon as they started recapping the trackpad stuff, you're like, okay, there isn't going to be loads for the iPad specifically. And they kind of did another trick because they included the update to the phone call UI, like the incoming the incoming phone call was in the iPadOS section, even though, you know, where do people get phone calls? They get them on their phone. But they were like, oh, because you can use it for FaceTime and Skype video, let's put it in the iPad section. This is one of the things I've been wanting, right? Like, you don't want a full screen banner. You don't want it to take over your UI and get out and get in your way. You just want a nice little drop down, just like any other notification, with a button to accept and a button to decline. And that's exactly what they gave us for iPhone and iPad. They put it in iPadOS section just to kind of fill out the features for iPadOS, but clearly it's directed for the phone.
Yeah, it'll be super great on the phone. Yeah, wonderful. On the iPad, the screen's bigger, so it was even dumber, but I agree with how you believe that they presented this for the reason of fill it out. The scribble stuff where you're working with the Apple Pencil and you're using it to sketch or however you're using the Apple Pencil for note taking, and you have a text field that you have to type into. Scribble on the iPad, which is like a phrase that came from the watch where you type with your finger and draw out characters. On the iPad, it's very similar that you draw out characters with the pencil in a text field. And in like real time, it becomes the text entry. I love this. Like, it makes me want to use the pencil a lot more. And I always have it and I use it regularly, but I definitely get what they're talking about where you've got to, like, you know, what do you do with the pencil? And you've got to, like, type again and then go back to the pencil. And now you can, it's more natural to not interrupt your workflow there. And I'm left-handed.
You just write over the text field and it will handwrite in recognition.
Yeah. And I'm left-handed and the pencil goes on the right side. Unless you hold the iPad, you know, with the camera on the bottom and the port on top. And so I often get annoyed at, like, well, I can't just, like, snap it right there because this isn't the snap side. This is going to be really cool. And then there's also, like, there's cool text selection and, like, manipulation stuff with the pencil too. Like, to scratch out text type text or, like, text is – whether it was pulled from Scribble or you typed it out, you can draw over it in a text field and that will delete it.
If you go into notes and you write out a paragraph, it can detect that as handwriting and you can select it as if it was typed, but it's actually handwriting. You can change the color, you can cut it around, you can copy it as text. Like, it's a really nice experience for sure.
It reminded me of how the iPadOS 13 had those new ways to, like, select text with gestures and everything. But they're all, like, multi-finger based, and it's just, I haven't learned them yet. This seemed more natural to me. Like, okay, delete text, scratch it out. There you go. I think those will be more memorable for me and more useful.
Yeah, and if you're doing handwriting, it is kind of stupid that all the nice, you know, cut, copy, paste stuff used to be only reserved for if you actually got the keyboard and typed it out.
Yeah.
And now they can use, you know, the handwriting recognition. And it's quite clever. Like, if you have little doodles around, it knows that's just a doodle. It doesn't need to select that bit. It only needs to select the actual words. And they kind of, like, outline your writing. So you get a nice little indicator of what's actually been selected. And I tried the scribble stuff the other day. And my handwriting is bad, right? Like, I used to have decent handwriting probably like a decade ago. But, you know, you just go out of practice, right? Because I barely write anything anymore. And so I was like, wait, let me try and write something. And I was like, okay, well, I can barely read it, but the iPad did actually translate it correctly. So that was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So it did work. It's not perfect, but it was pretty good.
I find myself at a place where for note-taking, it's surely just how people, you know, learn and remember things. But I find that, like, note-taking, you're in the keynote, like, it was useful for me to take notes. I've got a paper notebook where I write notes during the podcast and think of things I'm going to mention, you know, that you'll say something, I have an idea, I'll write it down, I'll get back to it. I prefer pencil and paper for that reason than, like, iPad on the screen, because it's like there's a limited text. For one, there's, like, a limited view, a limited canvas on paper, where the iPad is kind of infinite. But also, I'm used to, like, text on the screen and, like, handwriting on paper. And to be able to turn handwritten text into text on the screen, it's way better than the old version, which was you either type it out or you write it out, but it's still handwritten on the screen. And, like, my handwriting on an iPad is not what it is on the paper. So it's kind of inferior in all ways. Now I could see myself using a pencil for note taking, and you know, before you could search your handwritten notes, but there was never a conversion. And now they've gone the next step of let's turn it into text, you know, in real time.
Editable text.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and you can even just, like, if you're drawing a shape and you just wait at the end of drawing the shape, it actually, you know, does the proper geometry for you and stuff. And that's stuff that we see in other, you know, note-taking apps on the App Store, but now they've kind of just built into the operating system. So it's, you know, nice little tweaks like that that help the pencil experience for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then the other iPad thing they did was they redesigned Search. So, again, following the trend of, like, you know, non-modal Siri, now you can basically open what looks like Spotlight on the Mac. It's just the floating toolbar, right? The floating text field, and you just type in there, and they've upgraded it with, you know, deep universal search of more different things, and you can zoom along. So if you have, and they say that you can access it from anywhere, but I don't think you can do it unless you've got the hardware keyboard attached to do. Like,
I was going
to
ask about that. Is there a new way to activate it?
I've been swiping, right?
Yeah.
And I couldn't find a way to do it.
Mm.
So you still have to command space if you've got the Magic Keyboard or a different keyboard attached to bring it up, and you can just type and go.
Yeah. And then AirPods, it was kind of cool to see AirPods.
This is like a surprise, really. We didn't really know about this.
Yeah. Both in terms of like leaking or in terms of just being like a section of the keynote, they treated AirPods as like its own, you know, category. And what's new with AirPods coming this year?
Yeah. So they announced, and none of these two features are in the current beta, so we haven't had any experience trying them yet.
I don't think they'll be in beta.
But they sound cool, right? So they've got, supposedly they're going to have automatic switching. So if you're on your phone, then you pick up your iPad to watch something, your AirPods will only switch to the right device. You can go to your Mac and it will do the same thing. That could be really cool if it does it intelligently. If it does it in a way that is going against what your actual intent was, and it's going to be annoying. But again, we'll have to see how it works in practice. And then the other thing announced was basically like surround sound for AirPods Pro. So they called it spatial audio, but basically they're doing some clever algorithm and clever tracking so that they can play frequencies and supposedly make it sound like the sound's coming from all around you rather than just left and right. And then you could be watching like a Dolby Atmos movie and it would project the sounds in the relevant places over your head.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like using like the accelerometers and the gyroscope to, so if you're wobbling your head around, they keep it fixed in place and stuff. So it sounds very intelligent and very smart. We'll have to obviously wait for it. And I'm sure the spatial audio stuff will be a big play for
AirPods Studio.
Studios. Yeah. They come out, for sure. Because as soon as they announced it, I was like, oh, they're readying up for when they're doing, you know, over-ear headphones as well.
Yeah, those are sophisticated enough features that it allows them to market Apple headphones that are not more expensive to make, but they're just more intelligent than Beats headphones with their own set of features. So.
Yeah, and automatic switching is really cool.
Instead of working that way the whole time.
If it works as designed, I love it, but
yeah.
I'm a bit skeptical that it might, like some cases, it might be a bit weird. Like you want it to switch, but it doesn't, or it switches too proactively, and you're just trying to listen to something on your phone, and you just pick up your laptop to type something out, and then suddenly it switches the sound over. So we'll have to wait and see exactly
how it plays out. Before AirPods, I used the very first thing before that was I used Bose wireless headphones that could pair to two devices simultaneously. And so, for example, I think if I were playing music from the phone or watching a video on the iPad and then working out with the Apple Watch, it could be paired to the phone and the watch or the iPad and the watch. And so you get like the audio from your movie or music from the iPad or phone. And then the watch kicks in with like an alert to say you finished your workout. And then it switches to the watch in that moment and then goes back to the phone. I think if they get that down, then this is like a feature that we lost out on by going to AirPods versus other things. I'm optimistic it'll be cool though. So, cause that's something they've never done. They've had switching, like fast switching, but never, you know, from day one, people have like wondered where is this feature to auto switch? And it's been, they kind of confuse marketing of fast switching with an instant pairing with auto switch. So.
Yeah. So now they're actually delivering on what people thought they were getting.
Right. Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's the AirPods stuff. Let's take another ad break there.
Yeah. Our final and third sponsor of the show is LinkedIn. So now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities. That's especially true of frontline workers who provide care for those most in need. LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations, those that need to quickly fill critical roles to find people that help us all. If you're a business hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people. LinkedIn Jobs matches your role with qualified candidates so you can find the right person quickly from its active community of over 675 million members. Get up and running from the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. Simply start with your company name, job title, and location. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and experiences that you're looking for. It puts your job post in front of the qualified people that meet your requirements, people that you want to hire. LinkedIn Jobs finds people that are not only qualified, but fit in with your company's culture. It does the legwork to find the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person who will transform your business. So, to post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and have hiring needs, visit linkedin.com/happyhour. That's linkedin.com/happyhour. Terms and conditions apply. Our thanks to LinkedIn for sponsoring the show.
All right, let's talk about watchOS 7. This is the software update for Apple Watch. I'm not sure how to kind of characterize the size of it. It has some good
bigger
stuff.
Bigger than the iPad, right?
Oh, sure. Okay. Bigger than tvOS?
Yeah, it's maybe on the same tier as TV. I don't know. It's interesting.
Like last year they defined the size of watchOS 6 by the number of new watch faces, I think. Mm-hmm. It was fair to say. And then you got the Series 5 with Always On, and that kind of changed things too. And then they even included another new watch face with watchOS 6 in that update with the Meridian face, right?
Yeah.
This time there's the Chronograph Pro face. There's the extra large face with a new way of presenting the complication. And that's it for watch faces, I think. I think they kind of marketed on the website the new rainbow colors for different faces as new.
The pride stuff that we talked about
before. Yeah, but that's in watchOS 6 already. So you can't really judge it on the watch faces. And then some of this stuff is like, you've kind of got a... It'll be big for apps, but not big for like the beta version of watchOS 7. Specifically, that.
Yeah, I was surprised they only basically announced one new face, right?
Right, yeah.
And it's not even a face that I think most people are interested in, right? Because it's Chronograph Pro.
Yeah.
It's basically like Chronograph, but it's got a tachometer in it.
Yeah.
And by default, it just says tachometer across the middle.
Yes.
It's like, who wants that? I don't know. And then you can change it so you only have like a 60-second timer instead, but then it just says 60-second permanently across the middle as well. So it's the most like unappealing face I think they've introduced in a long time, but for me personally, like, I don't really know why they did that one.
Yeah. We've been calling it Infograph Pro through the reporting season of this, and it ended up being Chronograph Pro. And that's exactly what it is it's like, you take a face from the Series 3 and earlier, and you adapt it to the Series 4 and 5, but you can tell it wasn't designed for the Series 4 and 5. And Chronograph was in that category, kind of like utility, and the Activity Digital face, like some of those older faces, they wouldn't do them that way if they were designing it from scratch.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and now they've taken Chronograph, which was one of the faces from the first Apple Watch, and they've kind of reapproached it as like, what do we do if we're doing this as like a full screen Series 4 or Series 5 app or watch face? And that's what it is now it's Chronograph, but with like the corner complications where they go to the very edge and not like rounded, you know, angled stuff. And then, you can change the tachometer to common or whatever, you know, from being that to different versions of it. But it's definitely niche, I think. Yeah.
It definitely doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah, like, same. I tried it out, and it has some cool colors too. Like they're definitely going for like a look with it, where they got like this cool version of orange or green, or I think like beige, and they've got some neat default colors you can pick from besides like just white. But it's not. I tried it just to, like, here's the new face, and it's not gonna stick with me. So.
Yeah, like California was so good last year, right?
Yeah, California reminds me of like taking the utility face, which is just like watch, you know, an analog watch face with numbers around the dial, and making that, but for the Series 4 and 5. And so they delivered then. Chronograph Pro is just, it's the same approach. We take a Series 3 face and make it for the Series 4 and 5, but it's not like widespread, customizable, and, you know. It's weird.
Yeah, so kind of a bummer on the lack of new faces, at least at the WWC event. Maybe they will introduce more by the time the final release comes around.
Yeah.
Because they also didn't, like, address the always on stuff at all, right?
Like, yeah, I had a list of things that I wanted to see from watchOS 7, and just like wrote it down before the keynote started, so I kind of know like where I started and where I ended up. And it was to have an analog version of, like, if you're in an app on the always on Series 5 or eventually later, then, and you dismiss, you kind of like dismiss your arm and it's in kind of rest mode, then the analog clock with the blurred background takes over, even if you use an
digital clock,
yeah, even if you use an analog watch face. And so it kind of becomes like this weird screensaver mode, this, you know, not what a watch would do. And so I was hoping they would address that somehow by either doing an analog version of that, like resting watch face with a blurred background or something, you know, it could just be, we could see it, you know, they could do it. And then also because Now Playing is on by default as like audio apps take over if they're active, that's the default. You can turn it off, but by default, if you know, you're playing audio from your phone, your watch face will become the Now Playing screen, and it doesn't have an always on state either. And so you get that digital clock again. The only thing that doesn't get the digital clock is the workout app. And that was okay for Series 5, but then we thought maybe that there'd be a way for more, either more Apple apps or more Apple apps and third-party apps to do the same thing as what the workout app can do. And we get any of that with WatchOS 7.
Like, the Always On was obviously introduced outside of the beta cycle in September with the watch, but then it felt like perfect timing for, you know, the next version around for them to finesse it up and actually
get
the obvious stuff. Like, the fact that the Always On face when you're not on the clock face is just only digital just seems so silly, because, like, so many of the faces they share are all analog, right? Mm-hmm. But then you just have to get yanked out into this pretty plain digital experience. It's just not very good.
So, yeah, it falls back to being a digital watch, even if you
want
to be
analog. Disappointing.
Watch. Yeah.
Because their big like feature for watch faces this year is face sharing. And you can basically just like send your current watch face configuration, so the face, the style, the colors, and then any complication you set, you can send that to a friend. You can make it, you know, host it on a website for someone to download and install. I don't know if I'm ever going to use it, though.
I think it's really cool in that, like, if I were talking to somebody, you know, say I'm doing an interview with somebody and it's about the watch, and, you know, I ask, oh, what watch face do you use? And they've got like three favorites, then they could send those over and it could be like in the show notes of a podcast. And, you know, it's like not just a screenshot, but it's like tap here and it can be yours too. And the biggest appeal of that is that if you don't have the apps on their watch face, then you're prompted to install them if you want to complete the watch face, like they have it configured. That's neat. And I've shared some just in testing of like, what is it like to share them as a file and like just put them out there on iCloud Drive. And, you know, I've mentioned before that I like kind of making watch faces and with what you can do with them and like finding things that look good based on the limited options. So I like this a lot. I think it's
and they make it really prominent, because when you long
press
to reveal the faces, there's a massive share button right there.
Yeah. But I think the big story here is not just like how can you configure, you know, a set number of watch faces and customizability. It's to promote apps, and they show this by, you know, a few ways. One change now is that one app from a third-party developer can now have multiple complication types on a watch face. Mm-hmm. So before, Apple could do this with like weather, you'd get rain percentage and temperature and weather conditions, and they could all be different complications. But in an app like Watchsmith by David Smith, even though it's all about customizing complications, it can only have one slot on the watch face. And so in WatchOS 7, a third-party app, they showed Nike Running Club as an example, could have any number of complication types. And so you can have a whole watch face dedicated to the Nike Run Club app, and it's like the Nike Run Club watch face. And so then Nike would want to promote that. It's like, you know, download our app, which, you know, they promote anyway in the watch app. And you can get the Nike, you know, Run Club app functionality. But if you also do this watch face that you could configure on your own, we'll build it for you. And there's now a much better experience with interacting with our app. I think that app aspect of it is what is going to be the bigger deal here than like sharing between friends. Because they'll show it, like you mentioned, on the web, in the app store, they'll have like, with the app, here is every complication on a watch face. And so they showed a couple of examples like surf tracking and like an app for new parents. It's like, And because you can swipe between your watch faces, you can then have like an app version of a watch face in your lineup, you know, and just go to that as your, you know, way of interacting with that. So I think that's going to be more popular in like turning a watch face into an app mode versus like, you know, where do you put the temperature and what color is your watch face, you know, in the ones that we can all pick.
Yeah, because face sharing, like, it's so calling out for just a third-party face watch store, right? Like, especially as they barely introduced any new faces here. It's like, just let us have the whole, you know, creativity and diversity of an app store and just let us go wild. And then if you find a cool one, you can set it up and then share it with your friends, right? Mm-hmm. And so I really hope they are heading in that direction. I think arguments about like, oh, it would make some people make ones that look bad and so the Apple doesn't want to do it. Just like, that's just rubbish.
You can do that now with like Chronograph Pro, for example.
Yeah. Or on like the iPhone, you can make plenty of widgets that look awful and they're not going to not let that happen. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it's just a silly argument. I'd be surprised if it's not on their list of things to do. They just haven't, you know, got down there.
I mean, year by year, they're building the infrastructure for it. And this is part of that.
Yeah. And like, now you can build complications with SwiftUI and apps with SwiftUI. It feels like a pretty natural extension to make like clock face building possible with SwiftUI.
Yeah, I think that SwiftUI, so being Apple's newest way to code an app, so in watchOS 6, you could make a SwiftUI app, but not a complication with SwiftUI. And so now I think it's way more possible to take like a chunk of your app that you've made and make that the complication. So I saw David.
You can do a lot of code reuse there for sure.
Right. And so I saw David Smith like take his weather portion of WatchSmith. It's like, this is the weather app within WatchSmith. And then this is the large complication. And it's the same code. So I think that's pretty cool. You know, and that goes along with making app modes of watch faces.
Yeah, so they've gone from like WatchKit, which is terrible and garbage, and you could never make a nice watch face with that, to like SwiftUI for apps, SwiftUI for complications. Fingers crossed they're getting to SwiftUI for actual clock faces, and you could have dynamic, you know, animations and, you know, zones for complications and stuff. I really hope they go in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not this year.
Some of the changes, they've got some new workout types now. They tend to do this, like where you've got this category called other, and you can label it as something, but it doesn't do anything special with how to track like movement and give you credit for the activity. They've not taken dance and they've made dance a workout type, and not just dance in general, but you can pick like specific types of dances. And doesn't it kind of like, based on the type that you say, monitor like upper body movements or lower body movements or both, depending on the work on the dance type?
Yeah. So what they were kind of explaining is that if you're running, you're basically doing symmetric movement, right? Mm-hmm. If your arms are moving, your legs are moving, right? But with dance, you can just be, you know, doing this with your arm, just shaking your arm around and your legs are static. So getting accurate readings on your actual, like, exertion is more complicated. And so they're using, you know, special algorithms and stuff to figure out if you are doing, you know, upper body stuff, lower body stuff, or both, to then actually give you a more accurate reading on calorie burn and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a very cool addition to the watch and making it more accurate, because again, you could do other before, but just the other category is kind of a catch-all, is good in that you can label it correctly. But anytime they take something like they did it with yoga before, where they put some intelligence behind it and
specialized algorithms for the specific activity.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's a win. They did the same thing with core training, functional strength training, and then the big one for me is cool down. So, like if I'm doing a Peloton workout on the bike, then they'll often recommend to take a cool down class, and you get, or like an outdoor run, you just get different metrics for the workout and then the cool down phase. So like after a run, it's a good idea to walk a little while too, and kind of transition to not, you know, running anymore. And to have it all in one workout is okay, but it definitely messes with your stats and everything as like part of the run. So your pace, for example, would be much different if you included the cool down and walk as part of the run workout. You know, and whatever kind of workout it is, to have a dedicated cool down workout type, I think it's less about the data that it provides in that session, but it's to break it up from what you've been doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you don't know, when you're doing a workout, you can very quickly just add cooldown on the end. Because mm-hmm. you can swipe to side and press add, and you can click just cooldown and go. You don't have to cancel the workout, finish it, and then go back and start over.
Yeah.
They just added it on, which means you can just quickly switch from workout type to workout type.
Yeah, and that was a feature from, you know, we're on Series 3 and Series 4 when they added that in software, which is very nice. So I wonder if cooldown could be like more prominent in the UI, I think, over time, like if they wanted to, because it applies to every workout as an add-on versus, you know, mixing different types. But it's a cool addition. And then the biggest feature for the watch this year is the cycling in maps that you get from the phone. it'll be on the watch too. No, that's true. But sleep tracking, and the sleep tracking story is interesting because this is a weird connection.
It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, this is a weird connection to make. But remember last year with cycle tracking to track like reproductive health for women in the watch, it was a watch presentation, but you could do the same things on the phone and the health app. And in sleep tracking, there's a bit of that as well, where you can do much of what are the features of sleep tracking on the phone minus your heart rate. And so not as good, you know, accuracy of the data and movement, but you can, without an Apple Watch, do some version of sleep tracking on the phone that's more sophisticated than the previous bedtime clock. You know, there's new modes that are incorporated. There's a lot more intelligence if you wear a watch to bed in this case. And there's some nice considerations for like how do you manage battery life and everything. But it's kind of they mentioned that they've got machine learning involved. So that gives you some of the idea of like what's going on behind the scenes versus just like, you know, noting your bedtime and when you woke up. I would say, try to characterize it, it feels like it doesn't go all the way. Like, is this really what we've waited for and that they acquired Bedit for? Or is there another component here which would require new hardware that would make it even more sophisticated? Because it doesn't seem like this is, that's the alternative. Like, you no longer need a Bedit sleep tracking, you know, pad in your bed. The watch is now this good. I'm not sure that they've really... They haven't done a whole lot more that you couldn't do with an app. It's just built in now.
Yeah, that was kind of my takeaway too. It's like we waited quite a while for this, and it's clearly been testing for a while, but it doesn't seem that much far apart from what the third-party companies have already been offering in the App Store for a while now.
Yeah.
Like they do have integration with the system, obviously, so it can give you a reminder that if you've worn it to bed, you wake up in the morning and you need to charge your watch, it can like tell you like, oh, your watch is low battery because you've been using it to sleep. You should charge it while you shower and get ready.
Yeah.
Or, and it gives you like a little... good morning notification after you finish a sleep session, which gives you some, you know, weather and battery life and some, you know, summer information. And on the iPhone, they start like dimming the lock screen down before you actually go to bed. So they do have some integrations, but it definitely felt like, is this really it? Like, isn't there something more here that, you know, something really fancy that we're waiting for? And I haven't actually gotten a chance to try this out yet, but someone on Twitter was saying that the exposed data in the health app, it's good at showing like averages, but if you actually want to see like your last night sleeping and your day by day information, it's not that good. Like it shows you just like a summary average of the whole time. It can't break it down like hour by hour. This is when you're in deep sleep. This is when you're in REM sleep, that kind of stuff, where a lot of the other apps do already offer that.
Yeah. And that's where I wonder if a new processor that's made, designed to take on this task and a new version of the watch would add to this feature like this fall, you know, maybe we'll see. But it does seem like the benefits are, you know, before I wrote a story on 9to5 Mac a while ago that was like, if you want to take an old Apple Watch and then reuse it for sleep tracking, you know, here are 6 apps that you can use to do it. Just pick one of them. And then here are the modes that I recommend, like theater mode, so the screen will turn on and like, you know, wake you up, do not disturb mode, so you don't get taps on your wrist or sounds, those things. And this sleep mode kind of does all those for you in that the screen only turns on like if you tap it. You've got to spin the crown to get out of the sleep like lock situation so that you're kind of like when you are in waterlock mode so that you don't, you know, accidentally tap something and do something on your watch in your sleep. And it also kind of discourages you from like checking your watch for more than what it shows you. Like it's just the time very dim. All of those are nice. It does feel like it will go further in the future, because they've kind of just made a much more polished version of what third-party apps could do before, and they still sell Bedit, and I think you're going to get a lot more data out of the Bedit sleep tracker, you know, accessory than the Apple Watch. And so that they do meet, they check off sleep tracking as a feature for the Apple Watch, like you've had with Fitbit, but I'm not sure that they're even doing as much data analysis as Fitbit.
It just felt a bit anticlimactic after.
Yeah, totally.
It was like, we've been waiting. Like, why didn't you just add this, you know, relatively basic sleep tracking stuff 3 years ago? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. And maybe it's like, maybe it's that we expected more because it's been such a long time, and that really it was just that they were like perfecting what they've got and they didn't want to release something bad. But I can't help but wonder if it's that in the next version of the watch hardware that there's a new sophistication with that processor that they've designed to do more than what they can do now. And they do a lot of cool stuff. Like they take in movement. They take in your heart rate. They do different kind of analysis to sort of get the results that they have. It's not just like you're in bed or you're not, or you're touching your device or you're not using it, but, and they certainly haven't answered the question of like, I see a lot of people say, well, what are you going to do about battery life? And the best they have for you is that the sleep stuff, it's not very aggressive at using battery life. So like if you go to, they recommend 30% or more to begin sleep tracking at night, and they'll warn you if you don't have that. And I think part of that is so that you can also like function in the morning and have some better life, but it tends to use less than 10% overnight. And I think it's pretty inactive in that process. But yeah, I would say this is like step one. There's something bigger coming here with sleep tracking.
It definitely felt like it. And so we have to see the development there.
Yeah. They at least put more sleep data in the health app too, because they've always had that as well, as long as HealthKit's been there to support other sleep tracking apps. And now they tend to kind of like the framing of it is they do try to answer the question of like, why track your sleep? And, I think the answer there is kind of like, if you're just not by just monitoring it, but by being more intentional about it, you can have other good habits too. And that's where the, you know, kind of cool, the wind down feature where you say, 45 minutes before bedtime, you know, put the phone in this wind down state where you've really got to go through like a second lock screen to get to interact with your phone. Those are neat. If you use the Siri watch face on the Apple Watch, then you get wind down as like part of your schedule for in like the list of, you know, items that update on the rotation. So those are neat. And then also like maybe one of the biggest deals of all this is that when you added bedtime to the iPhone and the iPad, you got those special alarm tones that were so pleasant versus like the classic ones. And you've never had those tones on the watch. It's always been like one watch tone for the alarm. And now that there's sleep tracking, they've taken those nice bedtime tone or like wake up alarms. And now they're on the watch too. So, and you could do cool stuff with like scheduling and, you know, exceptions and snoozing and everything. Like it's a much better system than they had before. It just does feel like, a step past the bedtime stuff that they had on the phone brought to the watch, and that surely something that's more sophisticated will come in the future.
For sure. And then like the last thing they had on watch specifically was the automatic hand washing. Right. Which basically it sets a timer. It waits for you to do like hand washing motions, and apparently even uses the microphone to try and hear water running. And then it starts a timer and lets you run basically for the 20 seconds recommended time to wash your hands. And if you stop before then, you can look at your watch face and it will say, you've still got 10 seconds to go. And then if you get to the end, it will do a nice little animation and say, well done and stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, we know why they've done this, right? I'm in a normal year, I'm pretty sure this wouldn't have been a priority. And it's even shown by the fact that it's off by default. You have to explicitly turn it on in settings to even get this to happen. And I've been, you know, I've been running the watch base since Monday, and I've already had a few times where it just lights up when I'm not actually washing my hands. Like today I was washing the plates up after dinner. It popped up then. I was running I was doing a workout where I was just running on the spot.
You're logging the workout, right?
Logging the workout with the workout app, and it still prompted me to, oh, you're doing a hand washing session. So there definitely needs to be a bit more intelligence for it to actually be something that I could recommend people turning on as standard. I mean, it's clever. They can even detect that motion.
And doesn't it factors in sounds of like water running as part of the process and everything.
Supposedly, yeah.
Yeah. Supposedly.
I mean, I don't know what water was happening when I was running, but there we go.
All that sweat.
Yeah. I mean, it's a clever idea, and obviously it's a nice affordance for the global environment, right?
Yes.
But it's not quite fully there yet to be like, this is something you could actually leave on. It seems like there's too many false positives.
They weren't planning this, you know, 3 years ago, and now it's time. It's like, this is, a lot of people are asking, you know, maybe half jokingly, but certainly, you know, the idea was there to replace the activity ring with like hand washing rings and that kind of thing. And effectively, like, it's as if a third party made a hand washing app, which some people have done, but now it's integrated with the system. And that's kind of what it is. It's like Apple's hand washing app, but there's no app. It's automatic detection and an encouragement to go the whole 20 seconds as recommended. I have it turned on and I haven't had any alerts yet. And I've tried to trigger it and I haven't pulled it off yet. I don't know, but I think the user interface for it is clever, how it's like, you know, bubbles making the countdown clock and the numbers and everything. So
yeah,
points for that. I also think it's interesting to talk about what we expected from watchOS that wasn't there yet. All of the kind of school time and kid watch modes and things and like kid activity tracking that's different from standard activity tracking, none of that was there. And it could be that, you know, Apple has these feature flagged where they work on things and they can turn it off and they release it when it's ready. Or that there's a story to tell around a version of the watch that's marketed, you know, for that reason for kids. And that it is, you know, it's an updated version of the Series 3 with like a better chip or something, you know, and call it the Series 3S. And they present that. And then part of it is like, now that this is available, here are some more features with watchOS 7.
Yeah, obviously this is all just a hunch, but it definitely felt like they were hanging on to stuff, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, we see that.
The WatchOS segment is pretty substantial, and this one just felt slightly too slim pickings.
Yeah, and the other thing of that is that we've reported out from 95 Mac that there'll be blood oxygen detection, so measuring that sensor, that level, and we heavily suspected that that would be new hardware, not activating existing hardware, and so that will be another part of the watchOS 7 story, we believe, this fall. But it's like that with iPhone, it has been for a long time, where you get the software features, and the hardware is required for some other feature that is part of the update that they've also had to be working on. So I think later this fall, we'll get the rest of the watchOS 7, you know, feature list based on the hardware. Yeah.
And then they had some nice like HomeKit updates, right? Which is nice to see.
Can I say one more thing too on the watch?
Yeah.
There's also on the watch, there's the shortcuts app, which before you could interact with through Siri, but before Apple bought Workflow and named it Shortcuts, there was a Workflow app on the watch, and it was a way to launch it and like tap a workflow that you've created. And now you get that on the watch. So it's kind of neat because, you know, you've got your workflows there. But I think it also extends to complications and things like that. So it's really just it's bringing it back to feature parity with Workflow before Apple bought it and, you know, made it Shortcuts and integrated in the system.
Yeah, it's nice to see they've brought that back because a lot of people were annoyed when they took away the dedicated app.
Right. Yeah. And privacy.
Yeah, yeah. They always have a nice privacy section, right? And so they had, this year they've got all sorts of stuff, including like they're going to make app developers explicitly tell the App Store what kind of tracking behaviors go on. So they're going to put that like in the App Store card, for instance. There's microphone and camera indicators in the status bar now, so like if you ask, even if you talk to Siri, a little like orange dot appears in the top right hand corner. It's like, what's this orange dot?
You can't turn it off, can you?
You can't turn it off.
I want to turn it off, especially on, you know, back to the watch for a moment with Siri. There's no, they don't have the dot concept, so they show you a microphone as like an icon. It's like, yeah, I know, I'm using it.
Yeah, and the idea is that you can have some peace of mind if you're using a third party app that is, you know, inadvertently tracking you can see a little dot. And if you pull down on it, it will say, like, Twitter used the microphone recently or whatever. But in so many situations, you know that the microphone is being used, so you just get this annoying dot in the corner of the screen. So it's kind of frustrating. But I guess there is a massive conspiracy theory about, like, Facebook's always listening to you, or all this, you know, all this stuff's going on. Yeah. So at least here
I'm not sure that the dot and software is going to change that for people. Like, if you make the connection of, like, a classic example is that you discuss something with somebody, and then you start seeing ads for what you discuss, but it happens to be, like, on your network, somebody, you know, had also been like looking that up or researching it. And so there's ads based on cookies for that. I'm not sure that a dot that it, that confesses, you know, is going to change that idea.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Which then is maybe more reason why you should be able to turn it off.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do have a nice one for location services now. So say if you've got a weather app, third party weather app, and you want to have local location, but you don't want them to be able to know exactly where you are at, like the street, you know, the street road number level. Now you can just give them permission for approximate location. Mm-hmm. So basically you get like city level granularity for a location service,
yeah,
which is fine for stuff like weather apps or when you're going to a restaurant app and you just want to find the nearest one. Like they don't need to know exactly where you are to the GPS coordinate.
Yeah.
So being able to just say, just allow approximate location is a really good, that's a really good one.
And speaking of weather and the weather app, you now get the next hour forecast for rain in a way that's very similar to Dark Sky, which Apple bought, but no radar or alerts. So you still need the Dark Sky app for the full functionality.
Like, I'm not sure if they're actually using Dark Sky data.
Yeah, I mean,
still attributes to the Weather Channel.
Right. And it just looks like that style, but you know, maybe it's the idea minus the data. But at any rate, it's a very small connection, but not the full integration yet.
Yeah. Like the full Dark Sky stuff probably come next year with like notifications for, you know, incoming precipitation or something.
Weather app for the iPad. Yeah.
Weather app for the iPad, yeah.
I was in a situation over the weekend where my stepdad was using his iPad and his physical calculator died like after, you know, two decades or something. And he was like, where's the calculator on the iPad? And it's like, I don't have one. You got to go and add one. And he thought I was joking. Like, no, no, really.
That's funny. Mm-hmm. HomeKit. They kind of recapped the situation where they open source HomeKit. They're working on the chip standard connected home over IP with Amazon and Google and all the rest.
From December, right?
From December, right? And that's, they're going to have, they said they'd have a first draft of that by the end of this year, right? So that's obviously still work in progress. And then they did have some new features, right? So when you set up an accessory for the first time now, it's always, recently it's been showing you like recommended scenes to add the accessory to, but now they're doing like automatic automation suggestions as well. So, you know, when you leave the house, turn this light off if you're registering a light for the first time. And they show like three or four popular behaviors that most people want to do with these accessories, and you just toggle them off with a little checkbox and go, 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 which is a really nice advancement, because the setting up an automation stuff, I think, is a step too far for many people that just, you know, go and buy a smart home light and they plug it in, they set it up. They never actually go to do that stuff. So being able to like directly show this to you when you're setting up the accessory will mean people actually just have this extra, you know, magic behavior for free that they would never actually do on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The stuff with Home is a lot about the app itself too, because if you go to the Mac, then it's, you've now got a sidebar with rooms where it isn't like you've got to just click, click, click to get to different places. That extends to the iPad as well. There's this new area between status and your favorite accessories where it's like things that are in use with iconography for it, not just text. So those are some cool changes. The thing with lights changing that we, you know, what do they call it? Adaptive lighting.
They call it adaptive lighting. Yeah. It's basically night shift for lights.
Yeah. As we reported out, that will be cool. I don't think that's in the beta yet, from what I can tell, because I've got some of the app, some of the lights that change color temperature, not just color. And I don't think it's there yet, but that'll be neat to see. Like, you know, I it kind of changes my HomeKit strategy, where I've been focused on smart light switches and not bulbs.
Yeah,
and this goes to bulbs now. You know, but it's cool for lamps that where I use the different bulbs there. So,
and for HomeKit secure video, you can now set up activity zones, which is obviously like very basic functionality on all other smart video cameras apart from the HomeKit stuff, but then, you know, they're filling in the functionality, so you can select a zone and anything, any activity outside of that region just be ignored by the app, so you don't get notifications about stuff. You can just draw it. And they're adding a face recognition detection based on your iCloud photo library. So this is clever. So the faces library in Photos, it can now use that data to do face detection on your doorbell. So it could know, like, Ashley's at the door or whatever, or it's you, Zach, or it's
so you. If you want to know that your mailman's there, you need to take, like, a screenshot of the video, add it to your photos library, name it, and then...
Yeah.
Okay, and then you can get the... And then you get the announcement over your HomePod that they're at the door.
Yeah, so it'll say, like, Zach is at the door, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
that is
neat.
And on the Apple TV, it can now pop up like a notification of the doorbell camera.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see like a picture-in-picture window of the person pressing the doorbell, even and then with the option of, you know, talk over audio, whatever, straight from there.
In previous years, we'd say at this point, that's cool for whatever doorbell comes, but there hasn't been one yet. Now we've got some options, kind of. So Robin Telecom has like their big industrial one for seems like buildings and new installations. And that's powered over Ethernet. So it's like you really can't retrofit your home with that unless you're doing a new building. Yobi is a new one. They don't do HomeKit Secure Video. And they don't have a client app. They just do HomeKit. So it's kind of a thing to wait for. Netatmo has one announced from CES, I think, or maybe even last year that we haven't seen yet. There's definitely like you can get a HomeKit doorbell. Just maybe not in the configuration that you want with HomeKit Secure Video and the right, like, you know, power interface and everything.
We're getting there.
We're getting there. It's
time.
Yeah, it'll be so sweet when you can. But when I wrote about HomeKit Secure Video, when that came out last year and came to the first cameras from Logitech, part of what I wrote about was, you know, what you have today is good, but you're missing some important, like, features that you would have in a client app. And so even if you know, didn't have to suck the camera out of the client app into the HomeKit app, you want those client app features in the home app anyway, to really find use there. And they're doing that, you know, with the Zone stuff and facial recognition stuff, which is, I think, exactly what they needed to do in kind of year two of HomeKit Secure Video.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we just need a doorbell with it now.
There's like in tvOS 14 as well, on the control center bit, they actually have like the top bit of the control center is just your HomeKit cameras, so you can quickly see them and swipe between them, so you don't have to, you know, get like a third party app or anything to do that, or ask Siri to show a camera. You can just literally hold down the button and it will slide over and you can see them, which is nice. They're adding multiple users for Apple Arcade games, which is something they should have had last year when they actually did multiple users. Like a theme of tvOS 14 is basically tvOS 13 features implemented properly.
Yeah,
because now you've got multiple users for games through Game Center, and you've got picture-in-picture for every application. Because when they did picture-in-picture last year, it was only contained to the TV app, and you'd leave TV and it would go away. But now you have picture-in-picture for every app, third-party apps, first-party apps, and obviously you can switch between apps, and the picture-in-picture carries on following you around. Mm. So they've basically done multiple users properly, because now it's implemented for games, and they've done picture-in-picture properly as well, because now it works in every application. And if you get a AirPlay request now to the TV, you can just have the AirPlay video take up a section of the TV. It doesn't have to take over the full thing every single time. So you basically get like a pip for an AirPlay session, which you can obviously optionally choose to full screen. But if you're just like watching something, you just want to quickly share something to the TV, you don't have to completely yank the people out of what's actually on the television screen, which is nice.
Yeah.
And you can do AirPlay in 4K for the first time.
That's cool.
It's been limited to 1080p before.
Yeah. About time, because you've had a 4K TV for the longest time. It needs to be refreshed. So.
And they're supporting new game controllers, and actually the game controller API is pretty rich now, so games can actually take advantage of all the different buttons and different controls of like the PlayStation controller, the Xbox controller. Even like the PlayStation controller has a LED light on the back of it, and so now the API for gamepads for developers is so rich, the games can even adjust the LED light to whatever color they want for the game. You can show like health as green or red, and it even supports like rumble and vibration now, so you can send like haptic impulses to the controller and stuff. So they definitely flesh that out a lot, so that's nice to see.
Yeah, which just means that they're making their own controller because they want to support those features.
Yeah, I mean, we heard it rumored earlier in the year, and usually when Apple spends this much investment on like building out a framework to be that flexible, probably means they've got one of their own in development too.
Yeah, and their own controller would be an arcade pitch, and features that are unique to it would be like auto pairing and switching between devices. So you want to play arcade on your iPad or your Mac or your Apple TV, there's one controller, you don't have to sync it to each one. It's like AirPods, you know.
Maybe they do a bundle of Apple TV plus their own game controller for like, you know, 200 or something.
Yeah, nice. It's just like we saw game controller support, and then there's arcade, you know, so it kind of went together. And then there were no new screensavers for TVOs, right? Which is like you know, one of the...
Yeah, that was pretty funny because for the last like 3 years, they've done different types of error screensavers. Yeah. Although one feature they didn't mention on stage is that now you can actually choose what categories of aerials you want to see.
Oh, so good.
Cool. If you don't want to have the underwater ones, you can turn it off. So
cool.
Have,
so I can just do space ones if I want to.
You can have space ones, yeah, because I think the categories are underwater, landscapes. They're like, the, you know, when you're in the woods or whatever. Cityscapes, which is the ones where they're okay. driving over buildings. And then the space aerials. So you could just cool. have space if you just wanted space.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I didn't know that. And it's also nice that they divided out the original aerial ones because... you couldn't do that before either. It wasn't just like woods or cities. It was both in the collection. So that's cool.
Yeah, it's a nice change.
Yeah. And there's a couple of new things in beta versions too. So now with watchOS, there's going to be a public beta for the first time in July. Mm-hmm. There's only been developer betas before then. And then there's a HomePod beta with through the Appleseed program, which is like invite only, I think, and super limited. It's like the public beta before there was a public beta. But that one, I don't know how you get into it. I don't know. But
yeah,
some,
we're not sure about what's actually new in it yet either.
Yeah, but some people will be able to install a HomePod beta, which I imagine supports like the announced, you know, faces detected feature for doorbells and cameras.
And they are going to add third party services on the HomePod itself. So
yeah.
Eventually, maybe be able to stream Spotify directly and natively with Amtigo via AirPlay, which is nice.
Yeah, so there's that. You ready for the Mac stuff?
Yeah, exactly. The climax of the keynote this time was the Mac. And so we had bigger than expected updates on the operating system itself, right? Because, you know, everyone knew the ARM stuff was coming. But they started with a pretty big bang in that they have a relatively major UI overhaul for macOS itself. So it's macOS Big Sur, because that's a place apparently in California. Yeah. And they started off with... like an Alan Dye video talking about design and inspiration. And they have this new UI appearance for the operating system where you've got like bigger buttons, toolbars have less chrome, so they don't have physical button shapes anymore as much unless you like hover over them. The dock like floats, it's not attached to the bottom. All the app icons now kind of look like iOS app icons, but a bit more 3D because they're all like rounded rectangles now, but they still have like some form of dimensionality. You've got like the new... kind of translucent menu bar that kind of directly integrates with the background. Like the pull down sheets, which are like a classic of macOS, have gone now. Now you just get these like pop over cards that sit in the center, like these round rectangle cards. They're using SF symbols everywhere, which they introduced for iOS last year. You've got Control Center on the Mac now. That's nice. Notification Center now has like caught up to the iOS version because you've got group notifications, all those features. The same widget system that you saw on iOS is now also in Notification Center on the Mac, which is nice.
It's not a two-pane like, view where it's just notifications or widgets and you've got to click each one.
Yeah, it's and it's actually the modern notifications, like the iOS 14 ones. It's the same code, can be shared across both platforms, which is nice. What do you think of, like, because you're running Big Sur, right? What do you think of the visual situation?
Yeah, so... The push is like the big redesign, I guess, because there's work that needs to go into making your app fit in and everything. But it feels like it's not like the version of iPhone OS through iOS 6, and then there's iOS 7 where it's a whole new theme that was dramatically different. It feels like there was this evolution to get here, and it's not like just a totally different system anymore. Because if you look back at like Leopard and Snow Leopard had a look to it, when I started using macOS, and then Lion and Mountain Lion had a different theme that was heavier. They pulled that back a little bit with Mavericks. I guess Yosemite was when they kind of had the
flattening.
Yeah, the flattening that it's like, let's take that to me was like, let's take iOS 7 aesthetics. And by that point, we're on like iOS 8 and 9 and put that on the Mac. So for this to be the big redesign, it just seems like a nice modernization of the look and not like a dramatic, you either love it or hate it thing to the look. And so I have like no strong reaction to it. I just have more of the feeling like every year there's something in the design that I like a little bit better than before, where it looks newer versus old because it is. And I just have a lot more of that this time. But it's, like the most dramatic thing is that they encourage the app icons to have that shape, which even is like, you know, and you can play out of that shape too. But
yeah, like on iOS, it's strictly rounded rectangles, but on
yeah.
Big Sur, even the Apple apps poke out from that mask, essentially.
Right, and it's not the iOS design either. Like it's more texture than that, like more layers to it than that.
Yeah, depth and 3D and.
Mm-hmm. And so it just feels like to me like this is what people have wanted from iOS, and it would look great on iPadOS, and like maybe we'll see this design start with the Mac and move over to iOS and iPadOS in time. I'm not sure why it wouldn't. Like if we just look, I think one of the things that you found just to be like wow was like I think it was either Stocks or Voice Memos that had just like in a amount of shadows that it's just not like what you even have on iOS right now.
Stocks widget is the Stocks icon's like really well textured, and then you look at the iOS one and it's just like two flat colors. It's not great.
Right. Yeah. And because a lot of the stuff, like if you went with the kind of the default UI, just by running this up, you know, updating your app for this version of a big macOS, like it'll just fit in. I think it's just not super dramatic to me. It's just nice. Like if people think otherwise, then this is it has different tastes and everything. But to me, it's like this is where we were going, and now they just kind of accelerated it a bit.
Yeah, and like. I don't hate it by any means. Like I like most of it, right? Like, and it's my reaction to iOS 7 was a lot of it was pretty trash. But
and it took time to level out. Sure.
Yeah, it took, and especially the like iOS 7.0 was way worse than even 7.1 because they did a lot of changes. Even like
and every months. Beta of iOS 7 was way different because they were working in progress. Like cause
yeah, and then they
it.
You know revised it again with iOS 8 and iOS 9. Yeah. Big Sur's design. I think there are a few things that are a bit questionable. Like the menu bar menus aren't attached anymore. They're kind of just like separate rounded rectangles, like floating next to the button you clicked on. It's like, you know, the context is you clicked on the thing to pull down the menu. So why is there a gap? Or I'm sure the toolbars will be divisive because they've kind of made like the toolbars bigger with bigger icons, but they've taken away the kind of like button bezel that go around them. It's just like the flat icons on their own until you like hover over and then they give you like this shadow behind it.
If you click on your version of macOS and in the menu bar, and then you move the cursor across the menu bar to different items, does the window pop out or do you click again?
It just switches menus if you're moving left to right.
Okay, so that's just the thing it does. Yeah. It looks good right now. But so I like this look, and I wouldn't have noticed if it weren't different unless you'd mentioned it. But, you know, it doesn't bother me.
Some people are saying that everything's – because if you look at, like, the menus and stuff, everything's slightly bigger and they put more padding between everything. And some people are like, oh, they're going to make Touch Max. Because they're making each of the elements be a bit bigger and easier to click on. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. I think they just wanted it to have more spacing because it looks nicer and it looks more modern. I don't think it has anything to do with them doing touch or not.
Yeah.
Like, the icons, the rounded rectangle, like, uniformity is fine. I think some of the icons, they've gone a bit overboard on retaining the gradients in the shadows. And, like, the messages icon is pretty extreme on how much of a gradient there is, like, to give it, like, this 3D look. I don't know, like... It's fine. Like, I'd say Big Sur's visual overhaul is a welcome change, and I'm sure there will be some, like, refinements and stuff over the beta season, but it's nowhere near as offensive as anything of, like, the iOS 7 era. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's fine.
So the Mail app is not a Catalyst app brought from iOS or iPadOS to the Mac, but it does have this, it does, it like, when I think of the new design, like, that looks like a different app to me now. It's still Apple Mail, works with all your services, but just like the look of it is so different that it feels like a new app without new features. And so I like interacting with the Mail app much more now. And do you remember when they changed Mail, like probably around Leopard, Snow Leopard, where it used to be that you have, I guess, a mail list, and below that was like a whole like window-wide version of the message. And you could switch back to the classic view. Or you could have the new default where it was like over to the side and columns. It kind of reminds me of that, of like where that classic view just looked dated, even if it was functionally better than the default. The default seemed to be like, you know, visually it looks better and you'll get used to it. This seems like that to me now, where like even that version, just everything about it looks heavier and dated. And the new app feels like it's just like visually it's lighter and, it feels like it's been designed for today, not brought over from a decade ago. So
yeah, and it's not mirroring what the iPad app looks like, but no, it definitely makes the Mac and the iPad feel more of a family now, right?
And the iPad app has, I guess, has changed in a such a way that it looks more like this too. So
yeah.
All like, the new sidebar stuff.
The old, like the Catalina and like basically through Yosemite design was very departed from the iOS ideas, mostly because like the buttons still look like buttons, right?
Mm.
And so what they've done with Big Sur is try and make all that Chrome be more contextual, so you don't see the outlines and the platters until you hover over it, which makes it feel more like what the iOS design is. And everything's a lot whiter and brighter. They've kind of got rid of a lot of the grays and just replaced it with like white
or color, right? Or more color.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot more translucency as well. And so if you're using like vibrant wallpapers, that shines through a lot.
Yeah.
But it definitely makes it feel closer to, like, you could almost say the old Mac design was designed from a different company, right? Like, it didn't feel together, and they're not identical. But they definitely feel more of a shared theme now.
Do you remember Mailbox, the Mac app?
Vaguely.
Yeah, it felt way out of place in its time because it was trying to do the iOS 7 aesthetic on the Mac before there was even the Yosemite update. And so it just looked, it just seemed horrible. This reminds me a lot of that in terms of like just like the lightness of it all. But it's because it's all the same design and just evolved past what even that was. It fits in, you know. But I can't help but think that it was, I guess, the Yosemite update that was the big change from before to now. And this is just like the next version of that. And I guess the redesign is more in, you know, how does a column look? And like, is there, how is it spaced apart, and how does the toolbar look versus the whole theme of it all?
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm really happy that Control Center has come across now, because the UI they've done there is really nice. Like, you have a little button, which Control Center, and then it all pops out into these little like grid layout kind of things. And what's nice on the Mac is you can actually drag one of those categories into the menu bar to make a dedicated icon just for it. So like, if you want Do Not Disturb back, you just drag it into the menu bar and it makes an icon for it. So
they've
given it that like extra bit of functionality to make it stand apart.
And that's kind of like a shortcut of before you did it in system preferences, you toggled it on or off. And now there's like a visual component to it, and that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, and you see like brightness, but if you click on the brightness like platter, it then takes you to the detail options with like night shift and stuff behind it. So. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty cool UI. I think the biggest like real world difference for me is going to be like the fact that Messages is now a capable like application, right? Like, so now Messages is based on Catalyst, and so you get like the good search, you get the photo picker, you get all the messages effects, you get the emoji stickers, you get all of that, and you get all of the stuff that we talked about in the iOS 14 section, obviously with the pinning and the threading and stuff. So you actually get like a messages app that feels modern, and they've done a lot of work this year to make, basically now there's two strands of Catalyst apps. You have like the old Catalyst apps, which are kind of like old and crunky, and the pixel scaling 66%, and the controls look like the old version, right? But now they have a new mode which is optimized Catalyst, and that uses proper pixel scaling, uses native controls, and it feels like those apps feel respectable, right? And the Messages app is Catalyst optimized, and they've also done Maps as Catalyst optimized as well.
Oh, okay.
And so they actually feel like, they feel like proper apps, right? The old Catalyst is way different to what the optimized versions are like, to, you know, just usage.
And the question isn't like, why didn't they do this in the first place? It was just, it took them time to build it and test it and release it, because they were kind of using this for last year for podcast, I think.
Yeah, in a way, it was a more immature version. The same difference,
right?
Yeah.
And so this is like the more mature version of that. But it's not just for Apple now; it's for everybody.
Yeah, I think the biggest criticism of like the original four Marzipan apps at the time was just like, why'd they release them early before they had the infrastructure ready to actually do them properly?
Yeah, and I guess it was just because they weren't replacing something. And this is, I mean, we talked about it for last 2-3 years now, that this is now that they've replaced a system app, and it's better, being Messages. So. There's some things that, like, so in Messages, you mentioned that you get the cool pin things and all the new features. There is the app store. Well, it's not the app store. It's like the app drawer kind of, where you can choose photos, emoji stickers, images, or message effects. Being on the Mac now is very cool. You don't have the Messages app store, but I think that would come in Big Sur on ARM, where you can have iOS apps on the Mac unadapted. they just run, because then those messages apps would just run too, you know, maybe.
That's so, a fair point, yeah.
Yeah.
So you, and sticker packs, obviously.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. But I'm liking it. I didn't know that about Maps. I don't think I've looked at Maps on Big Sur yet. But
yeah, Maps is Catalyst too, so you get like all of the new stuff, like the indoor mapping, you get the guides like we talked about, you get cycling routes, you get look around for the first time on the desktop. So the two system apps that they've actually now gone from pre-Catalyst to post-Catalyst experiences are Messages and Maps, and they are very, very, I'd say they're very high quality applications for, you know, like you, the other stuff was like blatantly obviously bad. This is, you know, more than acceptable.
The whole map is just so much better. Like, it's insane.
Yeah.
It's
really, I'm pretty sure they've done optimized version of Catalyst for home app as well. Yeah. It just looks way better.
Yeah. And just putting the sidebar there, like it's nothing that you couldn't imagine is like what people, if someone spent a few minutes mocking up the design of how it should have been, this is what it is. You know, it's, that's good.
Well, yeah, because the old home app was so stupid, because you'd have the little rooms button in the toolbar, and then it'd drop down this little menu, which was like a checkbox menu of the different rooms.
Yeah,
it's like no one would design
and
it.
There,
that way
there were things like the when you were setting an animation for a time, then the date picker was so horrible, and they fixed that now to be what you would expect it to be.
And they got the sidebar for like proper rooms navigation. Like,
it's so much faster to navigate through. Like, you don't have to think, click. There's so much less clicking involved.
Yeah, they've actually thought out what the Mac layout should be, and that obviously translates to the iPad as well, which is great.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
It just shows how stupid the original ones were. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I haven't.
And then the other big part of Big Sur is a Safari update. So they have proper extension support now. So even Chrome and Firefox extensions will apparently be able to port it over to Safari, which wasn't possible before because Safari would use its own like custom API. So, and that's one of the big reasons that people say, oh, I love Safari because it's, you know, more battery efficient, more performant, but I've got these cool extensions on Chrome that I don't have Safari. So that's obviously what they're trying to attract people over with. They've got this kind of like redesigned start page where you can have your own background picture now. They've got updated tab design where you can like hover over a tab and it will give you a little preview. And they've integrated the translation stuff that, so the Translate app on iOS, now in Safari on both iOS and on the Mac, you can actually translate the whole web page as well.
Yeah. So, you know, and that just reminds me, by the way, like all the things that we've been reporting, so much of this keynote was like, oh, check that box. There is that. You know, there are some things that were not there yet, and we just think this will be coming in the future. But so much of it is like, there's the full version of that feature that we discovered and we're talking about, you know, for the last few months. So.
Yeah, and I can't lie. One of the main reasons I launched Chrome is to do translation. Because we have these like random Chinese reports, and the Safari translation is just, you know, not there at the moment.
I do them in Safari, but I go to translate.google.com and then paste in the URL, and so it's multi steps, you know.
Assuming the quality of Apple's translation is decent, now I won't need to do that anymore. I'll just press the translation button in the address bar.
Yeah, in space, in covering space news for spaceexplorer.com now, there's a lot of stuff in Russian and Chinese. So it's welcome because of their space agencies. So.
And finally, they obviously announced the big transition. They brought Tim back because they knew it was serious. They're saying,
hey, it's Tim.
The Mac is transitioning to ARM. Well, they didn't actually say ARM. They said, the Mac is transitioning to our own Apple Silicon. But obviously everybody knows those ARM chips, right? And they had the head of like silicon engineering, Saruji, did like a nice history lesson, basically boasting about how good their chips have been for the last decade compared to the competition.
Yeah, since the A4 and the iPhone 4, right, is when they've done their own versus how they would treat like a modem in the iPhone where it's sourced. And so it's been since the iPhone 4, all of the iPads, you know, they reuse the chips in the HomePod and the Apple TV. They make a version of it for the watch. The Mac has just, since the transition from PowerPC to Intel, has just been Intel. And now what they're going to do is start doing their, not the same chips that are in iPads and iPhones. It seems to be that the messaging is like, you're not going to have a Mac that has the iPad chip that isn't just the developer transition kit, that there'll be a new class of Apple design chips that are in Macs.
Yeah, they said specifically we're designing a family of SOX, SOC, system on chips, for Mac specifically, that are able to offer more performance and more power efficiency at the same time. I think what was most shocking here is they said that we'll actually be shipping the first Apple Silicon Mac before the end of the year.
Yeah, they're reporting before that, expected it to be mid next year. And so the beginning of by the end of this year, it moves that timeline up considerably.
Yeah. And on Monday, Ming-Chi Kuo actually had an analyst report out which said that Apple's first ARM Mac will be a 13.3-inch MacBook Pro, and it will be shipping in Q4. So that does actually line up. And then he also said there's going to be an iMac, an ARM iMac after that as well. So it seems like if Kuo's right, and he at least seemed to get the timing right, because they said they're going to ship the first one before the end of the year, that the first machine will be a MacBook Pro equivalent. So, you know, they're being aggressive there. They're not going for the obvious, let's just start with the Air because it's, you know, the cheapest.
Or a new version of the 12-inch that was discontinued, right? Yeah, exactly. Kind of going with probably the most popular.
I think the Airs are more popular than the Pros.
Okay.
I think it goes Air, then 13.3-inch MacBook Pro. So.
Okay.
But yeah, like, clearly they're gunning for it here, right? And they said, obviously, the first one's going to be out before the end of the year, and they're going to complete the transition within 2 years. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty aggressive timeline to go from zero custom Mac CPUs to the entire lineup.
Yeah, when you consider the range from MacBook Air power to Mac Pro power, that they seem to have an answer for that they can release within the next 2 years, that is pretty aggressive.
Yeah, and like, say the Mac Pro comes at the very end, right? Because that's what people expect.
Yeah.
You could imagine all the like the main consumer stuff being done in 6 months, being done by next WWDC. You do MacBook Pro, iMac, MacBook Air. You're basically there, right? Like, and then it takes a bit longer for them to do like a really professional desktop workstation chip.
But yeah.
It's a really aggressive timeline.
I wasn't, you know, we talked about this before in previous episodes. I wasn't one to say like, don't buy a Mac right now if you're in the market for one. You need one because it'll be a long transition, But 2 years is not long. It's not that long. You know, obviously, if you're going to college right now and you need a computer, or you're starting a job and you need a computer, like, you know, use what you have. And like, you know, to upgrade, buy one today, upgrade in 2 years is pretty fast. I think 3 years is pretty good for a computer. For you, you've been pulling one off for much longer than that. you know, it can be done. But to say
most people hold laptops for like 5 years.
Sure, yeah. But yeah. That 2 years is probably more about the Mac, like you say, about the Mac Pro than about the like MacBook Air or iMac even. So
yeah, they could have a 13-inch MacBook Pro in September that's running on Silicon.
Yeah, and the advantages I think are worth it. You know, if you look at the difference in what an iPad can do power-wise and performance-wise in terms of the battery life and cooling and not having to have a fan built into it, like there's...
Some yeah, and really obviously they're not going to abandon the current lineup, right?
Yeah, they even say we have more Intel Macs in the pipeline. So okay,
that they're really excited about.
Yeah, well, we're not.
That's probably the iMac redesign. But
yeah.
But like, and obviously, like all the current Intel Macs aren't going to stop working. That Big Sur will work on Intel Macs. The next version of macOS will definitely work on Intel Macs as well. Probably the one after that. Like, it's not the fact that they're going to get abandoned. It's the fact that the ARM ones are just going to be better. Like, if you're not in a crunch time situation to buy an Apple laptop, just wait a year and you can get one that's going to be better power and with longer battery life. Like, that's basically what they were saying today without actually saying it, right?
What changed my opinion on whether or not you should wait or really consider waiting to buy a Mac is that there's not a lot of drawbacks to the ARM Mac. Like before, it was like, you know, you probably ought to wait because you probably shouldn't wait because the ARM Macs will be brand new categories of things with their own problems and their own limitations. And Apple's approach is kind of like bring it all. If you can do it on Intel, you can do it on ARM. Maybe a limitation is like not being able to run Windows in boot camp. But they have an ARM version, but they don't license it out. It's only for manufacturers, but they could even square that, you know, figure that out between if they wanted to.
Yeah, the messaging here was like, we're not going to wait, we're doing it. So they obviously want developers to make native versions of their apps, but they are offering emulation story with Rosetta 2. All current iOS and iPhone and iPad apps will run on ARM Macs unless the developer explicitly tells them not to be. Mm-hmm. So by default, they're going to be made available. So that's like a million apps that will run.
So you could have the 9-to-5 Mac app for the iPhone and iPad, but on your Mac, and get those notifications even for like stories with alerts.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Thing. Yeah.
And obviously you won't get quite, they're going to be like bad catalyst stats, right? Because they're not going to be super optimized for the desktop experience.
But they'll be there.
They'll definitely be
there. And they'll perform well too.
You can have Instagram running on your laptop before they have a native iPad version.
Which is useful like as as a tool to run Instagram, different multiple accounts and everything, you know, you're pulling, if you're working on a desktop and your or a laptop and you're pulling in resources there, like to bring it to only on the phone is a restriction. So,
yeah. And they even said they've been working with big developers like Microsoft Office and Adobe Photoshop and the Creative Cloud Suite to get their apps ready to go, which obviously lends weight to the first arm Macs probably being more professional hardware, right?
Yeah, otherwise, sure.
Yeah. And they're offering a developer transition kit for developers, which is basically like an A12. It's basically like a Mac Mini running an A12Z.
Yeah, the A12Z chip from the new iPad, which is mostly the same as the 2018 iPad.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And they
512 gig SSD, 16 gigs of RAM.
And USB-A and USB-C.
Yes.
No Thunderbolt.
Yeah, like it's a developer model. I wouldn't pay too much attention to the exact I/O lineup. Like they even said this chip is not going to be shipping in the customer product, right? So, in the talk show interview with John Gruber, Craig Federighi said the DTK runs Mac OS pretty well, and in that case, our silicon team wasn't even trying.
Yeah.
And they're going to be trying for the actual actual real deal.
You know, there's so many features. Machine learning related, like however, where they do something very specific with the chip, just look at the Mac Pro where they've got the add-on accessory, the card or whatever, where it's made
afterburner.
Yeah. So it's for a very specific thing. So you can create something for a specific task and have it be better. So none of the chip, or the developer kit, transition kit, none of it is made to be, it's not optimized for a notebook or a desktop, and Apple's never made a chip for a desktop. For example, they've had chips that are in always on hardware, like the Apple TV, but that's a recycled mobile chip.
They haven't made one specifically for those products. They've just taken things that already exist, from iPad and iPhone.
Yeah, and so an Apple TV, like, you know, it could be way more powerful than it actually is because it has no battery constraints. Like, there's no power management needed. Where the mobile chips, you know, kind of begin with iPhone, and they have to heavily consider performance and power management. And if you design one that's not even made for MacBooks, but it's made for iMacs, or it's made for Mac Minis or some other new category of Mac, then we've not yet seen what Apple can do when they don't have to consider
with bigger power budget.
Yeah, exactly. Budget. Like an infinite power budget. Yeah, just heating, and that's not even a problem. So
yeah, like and the A12Z in the iPad Pro is very fast and competes very well against the current MacBook Pro lineup in a lot of tasks. So it doesn't feel like a stretch to me at all that they can deliver an ARM chip that can beat it. Right?
Yeah,
squarely. The concern was over the app story, but if they're going to offer emulation, it should be pretty okay. It should be pretty smooth.
The cutoff was 32-bit apps, and that was addressed in macOS before this transition. So that was
that was dropped in Catalina. Yeah, so that was last year, basically.
Yeah. Which, you know, in retrospect, like if that's going to be the cutoff, then not bad, you know, to address it before you even have this ARM requirement, because then
that's what people complained about last year. They're not going to besmirch the ARM Macs with that problem,
right? Yeah. So,
yeah, I'm really excited. Like the developers are starting to get their transition kits in July, and if there's a ARM Mac coming out before the end of the year, that's, you know, either September or October, pretty much. And so it's going to be a super interesting like end of the year situation to see just how powerful they are, because it's probably going to be some variant of A14, right? Because they're going to do obviously the A14 in the iPhone, and then they're going to do, I don't know what they're going to call them, but A14M for Mac maybe, or they'll just call them something completely different entirely. But I think the Intel laptops are going to get embarrassed, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, so the process for the transition kit is, if you have a developer account, then you request one and you give a reason for why you would need one. So it tends to be that you've got an iOS app that you want to test on the Mac, or a Mac app that you want to make optimized for the ARM processor. I've seen some people that don't have apps at all that are getting them too. So it doesn't seem to be that strict. It's $500 to receive it. It's a loan. Do we know what happens after that? It goes back to Apple. But we don't know.
They haven't said if you get your money back or not.
Yeah, so people you've got to be eager to want this opportunity.
Yeah, with the old transition kit for the PowerPC to Intel transition, it was $1,000 lease And then when you gave it back, you could either get your money back or you'd get iMac for free, basically.
Yeah.
And I believe when they announced the transition kit last time, they didn't actually tell you you're going to get your money back either.
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
That was only announced closer to the end of the program. So I think some people are buying these $500 transition kits hoping they're going to get like a free iMac. But I wouldn't count on it. You'd probably get your money back, but I don't know about anything else.
Right, right. Yeah. And I doubt it would be $500 and you have to send it back and you don't get anything from the experience.
Maybe you get like credit or something. Like,
yeah.
You send it back, you get $500 off your next purchase or something.
Yeah. And it's very hush-hush that you can't speak about it and talk about it because it's one of those programs.
The NDA is like, you're not allowed to benchmark it. You're not allowed to take screenshots of it. You're not allowed to tell someone that you bought it.
But. And the reasoning is that they don't want the story of the first ARM Mac to be the transition kit because it isn't the first consumer product. And the first consumer product will be better than that.
Yeah. But don't worry. People are going to tweet about it. It's gonna leak out some way.
Yeah.
We'll have coverage of it on Under Mac in some way. There'll be plenty of people on Twitter tweeting about benchmarks. Benchmarks appear on Geekbench, right?
Like, right, yeah.
Stuff is going to leak. So
before it's even out,
we'll see like the baseline performance of the A12Z, and then in October we'll be like decimated by the A14 version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And that was basically it, right? That was the wrap up.
Yeah, I did want to say, you know, now that we're doing the live YouTube broadcast as we record versus just doing audio only after the fact, this is the first time that we've done what is a 2.5 hour episode and people are still hanging around. So, everyone who's been here from the start or has joined in, I appreciate that. It is really cool to see those numbers and, that's awesome.
And I do want to stress, like, obviously we're a bit critical in like the WatchOS section and stuff, but, and the iPad section, I think this was a great event.
Yeah, right? Totally.
I think they did really well. They delivered in huge key areas. They fixed the phone call UI. They added widgets to the home screen. That's going to be a big deal, right? Like, even if people end up only using one or two widgets, that's enough. Like, that's what people want. They've got some great updates for the home. It's a shame there wasn't more on the HomePod stuff, but maybe that will come later with new hardware.
Yeah,
when they do the HomePod Mini. I think the macOS transition is looking fantastic. The accelerated timeline was a shock to basically everybody. Like, I certainly didn't expect them to. I thought they were going to say like, 2021.
You have a MacBook with a failing keyboard and. You know, the 16-inch was kind of tempting, wasn't a redesign majorly, so you weren't that excited about it. But now
what, 4 years to fix the butterfly keyboard?
Now it's like 2 years to transition the chip. So now, now you're wholly in the camp of you're not going to buy a new Mac until it's a version of the ARM Mac that you want, right?
Oh, 100%. Well, I think unless you like desperately need a computer, like your current one's completely dead, why would you buy an Intel Mac right now? You should just wait, and you'll get something that's way better.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on how long you're going to use it, the budget, the circumstances and everything. There's a lot of factors into it, but by bringing everything over from the Mac plus iOS apps, that gives you just one reason before you even get to performance and everything. So,
So in terms of compelling. how they presented the event and in terms of actually what they announced, this one's really up there on like the best one of all time. It's close.
Yeah. And for most people who experience WWDC remotely anyway, this has been like no debate, the best version of that because it's just so organized and not predictable, but like just being able to like manageable, being able to know.
And significant home screen updates for the iPhone, right? Like that's what people have been wanting for years. They're delivering them. So this is really, really, really impressive. Like a great showing from
coverage wise, we've always been able to look at videos and like report out new information based on videos that they release, but there's always been some sort of like some element of like we don't know what's happening in every single lab taking place simultaneously in person that before the video is out or if there's a video available. So it's been terrific, you know, considering the circumstances, it's been better than usual. So
yeah, for sure.
Yep. Awesome. All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. I think next week we'll both have more time with more betas and can speak more about specific things and what we think about them, give analysis. In the meantime, if you have any feedback, questions, concerns, compliments, whatever, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. Follow 9to5mac on Twitter and Facebook. You can watch the video version of this on YouTube. We're live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern time, 4, 3, 2, 1 p.m. Pacific time. And you can also follow us.
Where can people follow you?
Yeah, I am at ApolloZach on Twitter. I also write for SpaceExplored.com, part of the 9to5Mac network. Benjamin, you blog at
bzamayo.com.
And your Twitter handle is
bzamayo.
Nice. We will be back next week. Bye, everybody, and thanks for tuning in.